morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to February meeting of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. I'd like to first start by, if we can ask everyone to please stand, and we'll say the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible,
thank you very much. We'll go right into the agenda. We have our workshop, and the first is VDOT's financial status. Mr. Lawson, come on up. You're going to tell us all the good news.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Excellent.
Sunny day, and we're all happy to be here.
We are.
I like that.
Sure.
To report.
I'll second it. All right, I'll spend a few minutes with you this morning just walking you through kind of where we are in terms of our fiscal performance so far this year, looking at activity through January. On the positive note, our state revenue picture is improving. As we look at the total state revenue collections in the Commonwealth Transportation Fund through January, revenues are up about nearly 5%. Motor fuel tax collections up a little over 2% compared to last year this time. While that's definitely an improvement, it's still trailing the 3% that the forecast is expecting in terms of end of the year. Obviously, the spring, summer months are the better performers in terms of motor fuels collections. Motor vehicle sales and use taxes are surprising us. We're looking at collections there up about almost 13% from a year ago, which is exceeding our forecast, the state forecast of about 7%. While that sounds great, when you put it in perspective, though, we're still at about 2002 levels in terms of motor vehicle sales. Looking at the state retail sales and use tax, we were up about 2% compared to last year when you take into account the transfers and the Appropriation Act related to that source. To meet, while everything is looking up and looking better, to meet the revenue forecast, though, for the remainder of the year, and by then we're going to have to see a stronger second half than we have first half. This chart just gives you a picture by the main revenue sources, and this is actually as it's reported by Department of Accounts for the Commonwealth Transportation Fund. You'll notice that the third line, motor vehicle sales tax, you can see how that is a performing forecast at this point. On the fifth line, the motor vehicle sales, and also I'll point out the recordation taxes, that this line seven is also doing a little better than anticipated at this point in time. Federal revenues, as you know, are based, federal revenue collections are based on actual work that we are performing. It's not a grant program, it's based on expenditure activity. And with expenditure activity up, we're also seeing an increased level in our federal revenues, about almost $124 million ahead of where we were last year. And you can see from the chart on the bottom of the slide there that the two real increases areas there are in the construction arena and in the RO spending. This chart just gives you that kind of a picture from an illustrative picture when you look at the Highway Maintenance and Operating Fund, the Transportation Trust Fund, and the federal funds. All three of the major groups there are performing in terms of revenue collections ahead of where they were last year, about a 7% increase in total there out of this $1.9 billion that we've collected so far this year. Turning to the expenditure activity, our expenditure activity for 2011 is continuing to outpace fiscal year 2010. This is a good thing, and it reflects our efforts that we have put into place to get more contracts on the street and to better utilize the funding provided to the programs. You'll see here that We are about $160 million ahead of last year. This does represent only about 48%, however, of our operating budget. We still are trailing in somewhat and catching up with our activities within the maintenance arena and some of those other programs. I'll speak more to that in just a little bit. Important to note here that of the total spending, about 70% of the total spending is just on our pure maintenance and construction programs. This gives you an illustration, a graphic illustration of the spending by program. And you can see clearly on the top one, the maintenance program spending is definitely ahead of where it was last year. Construction is pretty consistent. Also see that ARA is up, and I want to also point out that the administrative program there in the center of the page is actually down, very reflective of our reduced workforce. And this is just a more detailed view of the spending by program. I won't get into the specifics here, but it does kind of just highlight to you how our spending of $2 billion, just over $2 billion, is comparing to the just shy of $1.9 billion last year. I thought I would give you a little different picture on our spending this month. Just kind of show you where spending is actually occurring and how we are paying for where the dollars are going. We talk about what we spend. When you look at spending through January, about 76% of our spending is actually related to vendor payments or payments to localities. The remaining 26% is really VDOT labor and debt service payments. Important to note here, our personal services expenditures are only about 15% of our total. And you can see on this chart, which is a comparative chart of spending by category between this year and last year, and you can see how the personal services cost has dropped from about 18% to about 15%. That's reflecting our staffing position of about 8,300 a year ago to our current position of about 6,900. You also note that the very first bar on this chart, that the plant improvements, which is our contract, main contract expenditure work for maintenance construction, is up from last year. Looking a little more specifically at the maintenance program, we are spending greater spending in the maintenance arena this year than we did last year. Spending is up about 15%, from about $100 million, from $644 to $742. Most of that spending is in our state-funded program. And you can see in the chart below that most of all of the maintenance programs, interstate, primary, secondary, and operations, are seeing an increased spending activity. Some of that is due to snow activity, I'll talk about in a moment. But also important to note that the program management and direction area has gone down. Again, more reflective of staffing reductions and a greater focus of the funding on core program work.
Mr. Chairman, it'd be a good point, a good time to make and ask a question on a point of interest here is, while it's good to talk about and it's positive, think we've reduced that area because we now have fewer people and that makes up a smaller percentage of the expenditures. I guess the question is this: is that always a good thing, and is it a good thing in this particular case since we've reduced staff? Do we know the impact on our ability to prepare projects, have them ready to go to bid, and do we have the right people in place that impacts our overall program? And project development, completion, and having things ready to is a very important aspect of it. So I wonder, because I hear some of the things in the districts about, you know, the staffing changes as a result of the footprint, and these people are not in place to do this type of work. Do we know that? Is there an effort to get an analysis of that?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Horowitz.
I think that we have the resources to get the work done, projects out, but it's going to be a combination of using in-house staff and probably increased use of consultants to get all of our projects ready. There are some of the processes that we have in place are going to need to be tweaked because some of them are not as efficient as they need to be. We're still going through that process. But in terms of having the resources to get the contracts out, I think between the combination of existing staff and consultants, increased use in consultants, we will be able to get the projects out. The next issue then, it leads to the question of whether that's the most efficient way to do it by using the consultants. And that's what we will have to be continuing to do some analysis of those areas to determine the most effective way to get those done. At this point, I have to deal with the hand that I have, but then as we go along and start moving projects, we're going to have to go and analyze our delivery of those projects. Are we doing the most efficient way?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I guess that's a point. It's really not, if you look at personal services reduction, it's really not a trigger reduction. It can be stated as a shift in which we would be utilizing it in purchase services and other things like that. So it's not an area necessary to be all that proud of, because if in fact that reduction caused us to not be ready to move forward on projects, then that would have been a negative.
Yes, I mean, clearly your staffing is a balancing act. As the commissioner pointed out there, we are looking at, you know, our current staffing structures and how it blends with their program.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, let's go ahead.
Has the combined percentage of personal services plus contractual services remained fairly constant? It looks like it's about 30% of the budget. In other words, are you making those adjustments within the overall 30% range, or is that percentage going up or down?
Well, you're looking at just the total of those two. There's still an increase this year on the contractual side.
Right.
So while we're only down about 3 percentage points or so on personal services, I think that 76% number I mentioned in total was down around 70% previously, and I can get you more specific there. But we are seeing an increase. It's not just a pure shift.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Dr.
Since we exceeded our anti-icing and snow removal budget already by $21 million, do we have a rough projection of what we think it might be before the end of the year?
you got ahead of me here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, sir, Mr. Chairman. At this point, we're hoping for lots of weather like today, and as we look forward to the rest of the winter.
And, can you guarantee that, Mr. Lawson?
I said hoping.
Hopefully.
No, not a weather. No, can't control the weather, unfortunately. But to address your question.
No, before you go to Dr. Davis's question, can you go back to your chart on the?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. We use so many different terms. You know, it's everything. All right. We our allocations are. We've gone out to bid. You know, here we're saying expenditures. So explain to us what this chart really is.
Okay, what this chart is showing you, the allocations are the budget. That is what has been provided to those areas in terms of what they are authorized to spend this year. So maintenance has a budget, current budget of $1.9 billion, which includes the unspent balance from last year. The expenditure column is what has physically been expended this year, checks written, payments made. So we've paid out the door $742 million worth of expenditure activity. So the difference between the two is what's remaining to be spent.
But could you just do me a favor in the future reports on this chart, could you just show us then what is under contract?
Certainly.
Okay. Because that's the key, particularly when you come to the maintenance.
Right, and we'll get to the later graphic in here that shows the contractual commitments related to the program.
Yeah, because, I mean, you all have kind of beaten me into submission and understanding about the whole issue on allocations, advertising, what's going out for advertising, and then what's actually under contract versus then what's under what we've actually expected.
I'm trying to hear what you were asking. The expenditures to date then does not include contracting, or does include?
No, the issue here is just, so even though it says we've only expended 26.5%, what is important, maybe even more important due to the fact, is how much we actually have under contract that will actually start next month or whatever. It's you have to look at all, in my mind, you have to look at them all as part of, to get a clear picture about where we are. Because just in December, you all put out, like, $400 million, $500 million,
$600 million? Yes, sir. About
400. So we put out $400 or $500 million in contracts. Actually went out to advertisement with $400 or $500 million, meaning that they're going to actually have them under contract January, February, and then the work will actually begin in the springtime. And then the expenditure levels will shoot right up until June 30th, and then we'll go right back down again when the new pot of money comes in.
Yeah, we would expect to see expenditure activity, as you mentioned, starting up in probably the April time period,
yeah,
and be heavy through November, really, as you go through the whole summer construction maintenance season. Looking ahead, as you kind of at spending of that $1.9 billion funding amount, the budget, we are looking, based on current projections, to end the year with an allocation or a budget balance of about $450 million, still higher than we wanted to be. We ended last year at $530, but it is coming down, and as we are seeing the benefit of these contracts that are going out, when we look a year further down the road to the end of fiscal 12, June 30 of 2012, we're expecting that balance to be down more in the neighborhood of $150 million. So
we should be getting to.
We're getting there, absolutely.
So it's just to get a clear picture, Dr. Davis, I think the issue here is this really, so the board understands that the expenditure number is really just numbers. I must hate to say it, looking back as to how much we spent, mm-hmm, versus how much we're about to spend in the month and two ahead.
Absolutely.
And that's what we need to see.
And again, just a little more detail on the maintenance. I'll get to your point here. We did spend about $200 million so far this year in paving. We are expecting to expend about $480 million in paving by the end of June. So we do have a significant amount of paving yet to be done this fiscal year. Snow removal, as we mentioned, we have exceeded our budget in terms of snow removal. That additional amount, we feel that we can cover out of existing reserves or existing contract balances. In terms of the remainder of the year, we're just hopeful that the weather will be good and snow will be small. And I don't know whether Ms. Sorrell is in the room. She can forecast what we might spend for the remainder of the year, but I have not at this point seen a projection of what that may be.
Mr. Chairman, because last year there was $100 million of additional expenses, wasn't it?
Well, last year's, the big snow activity last year was in the month of February. And into March. Turning to the construction program, just kind of a similar look at what's happening there. We are seeing construction spending is actually slightly less than it was last year, by about 1.5%. You'll note that the expenditures in construction are heavily within the interstate area, and we're also seeing the results of the shifts from the formula program to the more primary secondary focused dedicated programs. As you've noticed, the spending reductions in secondary and urban, really, as you compare the years. Kind of looking at it based on what we're doing in terms of construction, in terms of whether it's preliminary engineering, right-of-way, or construction, I want to point out that our PE work is basically flat with last year. And as we pointed out, our preliminary engineering is key to getting designs on the shelf and having projects ready to move. And this is an area that we're looking to focus on and to increase as we move forward to try to accelerate the program and make sure we have projects to support a future program. In terms of other programmatic areas, I mentioned earlier that the R program, the stimulus projects, is more than double in spending than last year, as we are well into to that program now. We spent about $180 million in total on our projects between the 2 years. Looking at the administrative area, spending is down. As I mentioned earlier, we've done some through blueprint. You know, we mentioned earlier, we've done a lot of streamlining, and expenditures in that area are down as a result. And as we saw from the graphic earlier, most of the other programs are pretty much in line with spending from a year ago.
Yes.
How much R money do we have? How long are we about it? Out of R money? How many years do we get it?
694.
694 was the total that we received, and we have through 2015 to spend it.
All right. So we're about 230 into it.
But 180 in total.
Into it.
Mm-hmm. Well, this graphic gets to the contracting component that we were kind of speaking to a little bit earlier. The chart here look maybe a little busy, but what it's illustrating is the total contract value. Again, these are our regular, normal bid-build projects where we have advertised contracts in the construction arena of about $1.4 billion that's on the street. And you see we have an outstanding or unspent balance on them of about $800 million. We have about $500 million worth of maintenance contracts that have been awarded on the street, and of which about $300 million or so is remaining unspent on those contracts. And you can see where, as we've been talking about the efforts here, how that balance has risen significantly and consistently since August, as we've been advertising and getting these contracts out. And as you can see, with the climb in the unspent balances, they are rising as the contracts have gone out and then pending the work that we get going in the spring and summer months. I do want to note that this does not include our contractual commitments related to our design build or PPTA projects, and we'll be factoring that into this information going forward, because that adds about another $800 million or so in terms of contractual commitments. Just to give you kind of a look at where we are in terms of cash, decided to give you a comparison to where we were at the beginning of the year to where we are today. And you can see our Highway Maintenance and Operating Fund, which is one of our main two funds, is actually down about $40 million from the beginning of the year. If you come down to the middle of the page, our other main operating fund is the construction fund you see listed there under the Transportation Trust Fund. It's also reflecting a reduction of about $55 million since the beginning of the year. And then the other big difference you'll notice is the very bottom line, the CPR bonds, where we are expending the bond proceeds that we received in May from the bond sale. We do expect to fully utilize the remaining amounts of bond funds you see, that $57 million, before our next sale that's scheduled in May. looking down the road in terms of cash, we do think, based on our existing revenue forecast and the projected spending, that we will probably end the year in highway maintenance and operating funds with a balance around $500 million. Again, part of that is about $40 million of that is due to an increased revenue forecast that was just done in December. Those funds won't be budgeted and included in your in program allocations until 12. So that's an increase in just pure cash that we're not planning to spend until next year. It also reflects the spending startup that we talked about in terms of the maintenance program and getting the contract work moving there. Construction activity does look like it will bring down the construction balance by about $120 million from the beginning of the year. Just to kind of wrap things up, it does, as you can see from the activity here, we are starting to see the effects of the increased contract work that we've been doing, trying to get things on the street. We are definitely expecting to see the results of that to heighten as we move into the spring and summer months. Again, the amount of activity that we have now that we have the contracts on the street is going to become very dependent upon how quickly the industry decides to ramp up and how aggressively they address these or spend down on these contracts. As we talked, the winter weather has been a little more costly than planned, but hopefully good weather will keep minimize that as we go forward. And as we've committed to you, we'll continue to closely monitor revenue and expenditure activity, and I'll be back next month to give you another update.
Any questions, Mr. Lawson?
Yes,
sir.
Mr. Lawson, if you look at the revenues on page 3 and 4, you add them up, it's about $3 billion. I know you need to add bond proceeds to that. My recollection is our total budget is about $3.5 billion in revenue collection. We're planning to spend $4.2 billion this year. Is that taking the reserves down, what difference is?
Yeah, the difference between the $3.5 billion roughly and the $4 billion is largely the carryovers from prior year balances. We brought over $500 million last year from the maintenance program.
As follow up to that, you pointed out we've done 37% of expenditures to date on maintenance, and I know you talked about paving, but our budget's about 50%. So, I mean, my question is, we got a lot. Is paving the main difference? Are there other maintenance projects that have been weather-related we haven't started? Because we've got a lot of the construction, even though it's 25% of our budget, but the biggest part we're behind on.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think that, as John indicated, we will start seeing some ramp-up in the expenditures in about, March through June. And we'll see some of those balances coming down, but it's going to take us a while to get our balance. We are expecting to have a budget balance on the table of about $450 million by the end of June 30, 2011. Now, that's down from, as John indicated, down from
530
or 530. But in 2012, we're expecting that to be down to the $100 million range. And it's going to take time for all these contracts to start kicking in. So I think we'll be okay, but it's, as I mentioned, it's going to be probably to June 3rd, 12 before we get it to where we want it. Get those balances down.
Thank you.
Yes, Ms. Coleman.
Mr. Lawson, the figures you've given us are, you have some month to month, some year to date, so forth. How does that translate, given that our time horizons go beyond annual budgets to six-year plans? Do these figures feed into a process whereby the six-year plan itself is adjusted based on increased revenues, increased levels of activity, or is this really just a separate accounting structure that's totally separate from the execution?
Now, the six-year plan that you refer to is the basis of our budgeting process. And the current year budget is just year one off of that six-year plan. So the revenue forecast that I speak to here is just the first year of that forecast. So So when we do look at the six-year program, it is reflective of the revenues, the same revenue forecast that this is based on. So the December revenue forecast that I mentioned earlier that's reflected here is also a driver when we look at the revenues for the six-year program. And we are looking at an increased revenue of $75 to $100 million a year in total as we look at the increased revenues as the economy is starting to, and it's expected to rise over the six-year period.
So the changes that may be suggested by these figures is fed in to that six-year program adjustment. For example, we'll start public hearings in the spring.
Yes, sir.
And so it's fed in into that cycle.
Yes,
it's not
absolutely
adjusted month to month.
Correct. So we do unless we do a revised budget during the course of a year, it's an annual update.
Gotcha. Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Dr. Avery.
From the administrative point of view, what is a reasonable balance that ought to be left at the end of the year as opposed to where we are? It would seem to me that the number should be much lower.
Mr. Chairman, that number should be substantially lower. I had a chart that showed at one point we were down, there's only about $16 million left on the table in the maintenance area. That was running pretty close. And I would rather I hate to use a number, but, you know, $75 million, you know, that gives you a little bit more wiggle room. So I would say that would be a target.
So we have a long ways to go then.
We have a long ways to go. We knew that starting off, but I think we got the plan in motion now. We've issued about $400 to $450 million of contracts this year, with those to be let in maybe February. We'll probably have all those contracts signed maybe this month.
It's not an unfair question. What is our greatest impediment, in your opinion, to getting that money obligated by contract? Is it staff? Because we have the projects identified in the six-year plan. I'm just curious what the impediment is.
I think we were a bit conservative in letting out some of those contracts. We were going through a period of our revenues were falling. And we didn't know how far they would fall. And we were taking an educated guess. And so we may have been a bit conservative when you, the Monday morning quarterback, you kind of look back. And you said, based upon what happened, maybe I should have not been as conservative. But once we made that decision to slow down things, it really slowed it down. Now we got to try to figure out how to ramp them up. I believe that what we've done in issuing $450 million in contracts to be signed probably in February, I think it's going to jumpstart it. We are going to do the same thing, another $450 next maintenance cycle for contracts. That's pretty much double what we normally would do in any year. Now, in the 2013 year, you'll probably see our contracts leveling back down. Because now I have to maintain.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I got confused on something earlier. When I was looking at page 3 and 4, going back to Mr. Lane's question, I see $2.37 billion in highway maintenance and operating on 3 and then $650 and change on 4, which would total about $4 billion. $3 billion. And I thought he said 3.5.
Bonds and other things need to be added. Our total is 3.5, and this doesn't include the bond issuances, I think, to get to the 3.5.
Correct. You've got...
So this doesn't show the bond revenue money.
Right.
It only shows the federal and the highway operating, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, what I've illustrated here are the main sources, the state revenues and then the federal revenues.
Okay, so you got to add $500 million to that. Is that correct? In bonds?
You have to add, well, the bonds was about $300 million, I think was what the bond component was. But you also have to, a difference here I have to point out between on the revenue side, on the federal revenue, this federal revenue is based on, it's what I'm showing you what we've collected, not what was budgeted. Federal revenue is a little confusing in that we budget it based on when it's made available to us by the federal government. What you see here in terms of a collection is based on what we've actually received in terms of activity that's been incurred, because it's a reimbursement-based program. So you really can't add those two values together to come to a total.
I guess what I'm trying to get to is a snapshot that ties these numbers to what the declining balance is, and I can't do that with what I have here, I don't believe. I'm looking to tie these numbers in specific that you've given us to how much we will be down in our balance to sort of see where it is. And when I looked at it earlier, I couldn't really get there. I didn't have the $500 million or the $300 million.
Okay.
So it's now 3.3 million, and we're spending 4.2. So I would expect the balance to come down by 900.
But you're right, Chef. But we're going
to
be 500 million. We're not going to get to the 4.2. And this cash collect.
I'll work on a better illustration for you before you next month.
See what I'm trying to get
Absolutely.
At. I mean, that's sort mm-hmm. of the that's sort of the issue. And as I see, I'm sensitive and understand. That we're sort of like a locomotive here. I mean, you can't just get going 90 miles an hour all of a sudden. It takes a while to get up to speed and have that happen. And the chairman has been clear to us that there's a lot of stuff in the contracts mill, which would be helpful to sort of see that along the same time, because that shows that momentum's gathering and we're going to get there. But, obviously what we're sort of trying to get at is, when's that going to be? How fast do we chip away at that? And I know you're still working to get there. I understand that, but that's what I'm looking for, and I can't get that.
Okay. I'll work on that for you.
Thank you.
Chairman, could we? One thing I think would be helpful in this is if we'd get the same presentation each time so that we can track it. And I would ask that part of that be back to the budget. In other words, we start with a budget. It would be nice to see every time when we get it how we can relate back to it. So if we could do that, I think that'd be appreciated.
And the budget's changing, but we don't really see that change.
Well, I don't think the budget changes.
Well, because the federal revenues are
right.
Changing.
But that would be helpful, I think, and so we're all speaking from the same seat of music.
Mr. Rich?
Okay.
At what point do we get in revenues where we go back to the statutory formulas and allocations? What point do we have to reach where we have some sense of normalcy, so to speak?
That's a complicated question to answer. Because it's a combination of levels of revenue as well as levels of funding. Programmatic levels. So as the needs of the Highway Maintenance and Operating Fund, the maintenance program per se, as it grows, revenue has to grow in order to help address that. As we look down the road for the next through 17, as we begin to work on the next forecast or in next year, 6 years improvement program, revenues never reach the point that we do have anything available to go through that statutory formula.
Okay. So no time in the foreseeable future.
No, sir.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Yes.
I think a follow up on Mr. Rich's question is: could we get the hierarchy that makes that decision on that formula implementation and not all, or could we get a definition of the model, an explanation of the model that's used for we're going to be really in trouble on the secondary side not having any monies out there.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be good to have a little understanding of that, and if it will ever come back or what's going to trigger it. That would be helpful to me.
Okay, yeah, we go back to that graphic illustration that I think we distributed a few months ago that kind of shows how everything flows through, kind of at least graphically shows you where it stops and how that process works. But I can redistribute that to the group.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The looking at it from the federal side of things, we're a donor state. What is it, 94% of the revenues come back into Commonwealth?
92.
What, 92% come back in? What is, with that 8%, what does that represent on an annual basis? In other words, instead of how we're dividing up the pie that we get, if we ended
the
up
eight,
not being
8%,
donor,
we're getting about, we get about $1 billion, so.
The 8% would be $80 million a year?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Lawson, actually, just one last question, I'm sorry. So, you're showing the maintenance dollars at this fiscal year. I mean, you're comparing 2010-2011. When, how do we ever look, be like look back further than that? I mean, at what point does, let's say, a contract that we may have awarded or maybe allocated money towards in 2009? Does that ever become a 2010 or a 2011 project? I mean, how do we, you see what I'm saying? I mean, so like last year when, let's just say you go back to the audit, we had $525 million worth of unexpended dollars on June 30th. Now, my assumption is a certain percentage of that was probably some fiscal year 2009.
Yes, sir.
So when we're looking at expenditures, we're looking at actual money out the door no matter what year the contract was.
Correct.
Money was allocated or awarded.
That the $1.9 billion total that I mentioned for maintenance is a combination of this year's funding plus anything that's carried forward from the prior years. And then, therefore, the spending that you're I'm reporting is reflective of the expenditures of any activity in this fiscal year.
Okay. So going back to my question before about where we can show allocations, advertisements, contracts, we need to have a separate slide because actually then that, I don't want to put it with, actually with expenditures versus where we are expenditures because actually that's a little bit of,
it's a little misrepresented, right? No? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. We will work on a schedule to show some of the previous commitments or encumbrances that we have for from previous years.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's a construction contract, I mean, it's overhead, it's year in, year, you know, it's year by year. Construction is tied to a project, so you can, and it's, you expect it's going to be multi-year. The problem with maintenance, I think, is where the prior administration kind of got screwed up in how they were looking at things, is that you can't treat them like a construction project. So they were at least allocating money, maybe even awarding contracts, or maybe and never actually expending the money. So on the paper, it looked like they were, the money had actually gone out the door, when in reality, it had not gone out the door. My issue now is I want to make sure when we say we expended a certain amount of money in fiscal year 2011, that it's 2011 dollars that's being expended versus might have been fiscal year 2010 or earlier.
We will work on a schedule for you the next...
What I'm looking for, again, is make it as transparent as possible so that the CTB knows that the dollars that was maybe, I mean, let's face it, budgeted or approved in 2009, 2008, actually got spent. I mean, again, it's easier with a construction project. We know it's moving through that pipeline, but it's not easy on the maintenance because we just do a lump sum, don't we? We just simply say, for the most part, on the maintenance side, we approve a line item.
It's actually a very detailed budget around the maintenance program.
Okay, I'll just again, we'll just keep on evolving.
Certainly.
Appreciate it very much, Mr. Lane.
Chairman, I don't mean to beat a dead horse, but is our budget on an expenditure basis? I mean, when we come in and approve a budget, is that on an expenditure basis that we're going to, or is that cash in, cash out?
Our budget is. It's more of a programmatic budget. in that, as I mentioned with the federal funds, we are, in order to support the six-year improvement program, we are basing the budget on the funds that we see being made available to us.
Right.
And then we allocate in the budget those funds over the period of time. So it's not, especially from a construction side, it is not directly reflective of the expenditure that we anticipate to incur that year.
But once we have a budget, we've made changes to it, obviously, and we approve changes as we go. Well, I just would like to see whatever those assumptions are, when you address us or we get a financial update, that budget compared to what we've actually done on that basis, whether it's revenues or expenditures, so that I have a basis to go for them to see how we're doing. It's very much on our mind with Hampton Roads. I mean, you all know about what's going on with HRT and how they're, and I just want to make sure I can look somebody in the eye and say, I know how we're doing to our budget. And that doesn't seem to me to be,
Mr. Chairman,
that
yes,
difficult.
Really.
What we had talked about was maybe having just a session on some of the finances, and we could announce it maybe an hour before the board meeting,
mm-hmm.
and we would announce that and the public could come and just explain how we developed the budget, some of the assumptions, because we have two different facets of this in developing that budget. One is that six-year plan. And we have to anticipate our revenue and then program our projects based upon that plan. But at the same time, when we develop the budget that must go into the statewide budget, it is based upon what we anticipate receiving and what we anticipate expending. And so we need to kind of explain that to you, and I thought maybe we could have a special session before the meeting. And just to kind of walk through some of the ABCs of developing the budget. And maybe we can do that for maybe the next meeting.
Instead of ABCs, or rather have 1, 2, 3s.
Oh, the 1, 2, 3s.
And then just report to us on a consistent basis. that would be helpful.
Great. Right.
Okay.
Just one more quick question. Do you think,
Scott? Listen, you never get it. Why don't you pull a chair up?
Yeah.
I'll be too low then.
He's off his head.
Possibly give us, John, some kind of little chart that shows how much money it would take to get back to normalcy with the statutory formulas. What that would be, what number that would be.
We can do that. We can show in terms of the way the formula works, what it would take to have a meaningful amount of funding going through the formula.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Lawson, you better run while you still can.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is the Transportation Performance Trend Report 2009. Mr. Tyer.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Members of the CTB, I will walk you quickly through the 2009 performance report. I will just tell you that all 50 measures and all of the narrative associated with them are available online in their entirety. You can see here the seven categories that we use to assess our annual performance, and this is the fourth iteration of this report, and many of these measures have carried over from year to year. Just going through the highlights, in terms of safety and security, fatalities decreased to its lowest level in 40 years. Seatbelt usage is up to its highest usage ever. In terms of prevention and maintenance, you can see the average age of transit vehicles here in the Commonwealth are lower than the national average and lower than the guideline for receiving federal funding. Dovetailing with what Mr. Lawson just told you about increased need to transfer money from the Transportation Trust Fund to the HMOF, you can see that our interstates and our primary pavements are much below their targets, 80% for interstates, 76% for primaries. Our target is 82% as being in fair condition or better. I would just note, it's not on the slide, but bridges with a target of 92% are actually at 91%, so we're pretty close there. In terms of mobility, connectivity, and accessibility, HOV usage is up, but the volume through the port by rail or barge is down from what it was in 2008, but that is also before our huge rail expansion with the Commonwealth Railroad, and also as prior to our taking possession of the APM or leasing the APM facility, which has both Class 1 railroads on it at the port, so we expect those numbers to go up. In terms of environmental stewardship, our emissions continue to decrease, and we replace wetland at a faster rate, actually 85% faster than we take them out. Economic vitality is down, and I will talk to you that in a little bit greater detail in a moment. We contributed just $8.8 billion to the gross state product in 2009. In terms of land use and transportation, vehicle miles traveled on a per capita basis are down. Some of that is related to just a decline in the economy and fewer people going to work, but also some of it is related to our more aggressive approach in getting folks off the roads and into other transit opportunities. And you can see that almost 7% of state workers teleworked, and hopefully with Director Drake's telework credit bill that is now passing its or finding its way through the General Assembly, these numbers will increase for both the public and the private sector. In terms of on time and on budget, 82%, that's higher than it was a year before. Our target is 77%. I'm not sure why our target is only three quarters of our projects to be on time and on budget, but I will tell you that the 82% is an improvement over what it was the prior year. This is what our grades look like in terms of all categories of our performance report in 2009. You can see that economic vitality, we didn't do very well. The others are...
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
On that, I mean, it stands out. My son brings that home from school, and he's got a problem. How do we measure? Because I see in the when you went through sort of the descriptions on it, contributed $8 billion under economic vitality, but we got an F. How do we determine if it's a A, B, C, D, or F?
I can go through the scoring for you of how, but I can also tell you what our plan is to rectify that, but let me talk to you a little bit about the scoring.
I mean, I guess that's what I'm looking for is the scoring.
Every measure that we have, all 50 measures, have a desired trend upward or downward depending on what we're trying to do. So if we are moving in the positive, in the direction that we intend, we get a plus point. If we're moving in the opposite direction, we get a minus point, and then there are gradations of half points and zeros along the way. So in terms of all of these items related to economic vitality, in order for us to get an F, you can see them on this slide, we've gone in the wrong direction in all categories.
So number of workers employed by transportation sectors down, transportation sectors contributions down, volume of freight down, et cetera.
Right. Mr. Chairman.
Wow.
Yes, Ms. Karsinski.
David, I guess following on Cord's question, we hear of how well Dulles is doing and the port is doing. So why are we at an F, though? They don't seem to match up with the numbers we hear from those two entities, especially, which are the two economic engines of the Commonwealth.
Well, I can speak to the port because that's within our secretariat a little bit easier than I can speak to the international air carrier facilities, which are not within our secretariat. These are 2009 measures, so this was at our low point in the recession. In 2010, a couple of things happened, especially at the port. We decreased our costs there. We increased our efficiency, and we now have access to both Class 1 railroads there. So when these numbers come out in 2010, you will see us start to move above that 600,000 container level at which we were at for this period. In terms of moving forward, you can see what the measures are, the contribution, the number of workers, the volume of freight, port share of East Coast, and some of the things that I've talked to you about going on at the port, and more importantly, the things that are before us now in the General Assembly. You can see that the governor's omnibus transportation plan would contribute $6 billion of economic impact and support 48,000 jobs. Important to this group is probably the protection of the Commonwealth Transportation Fund from transfers to the general fund, what we refer to as the constitutional lockbox. A couple other things that we've been working on and have gotten through both chambers is the port volume tax credit and the per container tax credit. Again, I alluded to Ms. Drake's bill for telework credits will make the Commonwealth a place for people to come and invest in terms of creating jobs. There are also some bills that have been carried by Delegate Oder and some others that would increase our airport's competitiveness in the regional and the mid-Atlantic economy. So we expect as a result of these bills that we are pushing through and the slight recovery in the economy for this economic vitality grade to improve. Well, it can't get worse, so we certainly expect it to improve.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Miller.
You threw this one high up, so I'm going to hit it for you. Program delivery, 82% on time and on budget, target 77. I'm no engineer, and I don't build highways, but I have some reasonably complex defense contracting projects, and mine don't, you know, a 77 goal, or excuse me, a 77 target. Can you help me with that? Because, you know, I'm a rookie here, but it just sort of jumps off the pages. That's a C or a C minus or a D in my world.
Well, when we started this process, that was like stretching objective because we were in the low 70s to mid 70s. So as we meet our goal, and now we've exceeded it, at next iteration, it would be time to up that percentage, say, to 85 or some greater number. But
I guess maybe
if you consider from where we've come to where we are, that's huge.
Well, when my child is flunking a subject, I don't give him a goal to get a B. You know, I say, you know, you ought to be able to get a B or B plus if I think you can. Now, my problem is I don't know what's reasonable. But certainly from a sort of a rookie public perspective, to say our goal is 77 just sort of jumps off the pages. That's not real. It doesn't look good.
I agree with you.
Mr. Secretary, who sets the goal?
I was going to get to that. How do we set the goal? And what is really, if we were the smoothest running we could ever possibly be, I know stuff happens. You know, it's not always on time. It's not always on budget. But if we looked out across the country and looked at other similar groups, what's a reasonable stretch goal? And I don't know the answer to that.
Well, the question I think that begs is, our target on time on budget, have we adjusted what our on time on budget targets are or goals? You know, have we extended the time and have we increased the budget?
Right, right,
or
right.
Have we actually performed better in order to meet this? I think that's a critical question there. You can meet it both ways by dumbing down what your budget and your timelines are. How have we measured in that sense?
Mr. Chairman, we have adjusted the on-time, on-budget goal pretty much every year, and we've tried to increase it for a while almost every year.
But I mean, have we increase the length of time? Let's say originally our on time would have been to get a project done in 1 year, but now it's to get it done in 2 years.
No.
It would have been, here's the budget, $2 million, now it's $4
million. We kept to the rules. The rules that measured whether you were on time and on budget, we did not change those rules.
Correct.
In terms of the goals, we did try to inch up those goals a little bit each year. But let me say that when you have a few projects and you miss one project, you miss your goals. When you have a number of projects that you're working from, you can miss one and you still got a good shot of making your goals. What we've been faced with here lately is that we have few projects and it's becoming very difficult to meet the goals because if something happens on a project, if we couldn't get the right-of-way cleared or we had to add a work order because we found something we didn't expect in the construction of the project, that made us miss that goal. And that project missed, and because we had few projects, we probably missed the overall goal. Our staff has been very dedicated to not trying to let the rules drive the project. In other words, if there's something that needs to be done because was something unexpected, I could ignore the work and move forward and build the project and meet the goal. But if I add that work order because it's the right thing to do, then I probably miss that goal because it's going to add more time to the project. And we've stressed that if you see where there's work to do and you need to do it and it's good business, then let's do the work. And we'll deal with the outcome of the goals. But we do try to ramp up those goals a little bit every year based upon the number of projects. We anticipate the projects we have for the year, and we try to look at those projects and then develop a target, both for on time and on budget. And then we do a combined goal, which would be for the program delivery, both on time and on budget, and we come up with that 82%.
The answer, before we move too far, the answer to the question from this side of the room was, who sets the goal? We in the Office of Intermodal Planning, we set the goals for all 50 measures every year.
One other question, as a novice on the board, why is there a lag time? Here we are in February of 11, and this report is 09. Is it just compiling the data?
Yes, for the most part. I mean, we could get this to you maybe a little bit earlier in 2000. We could have gotten it to you in 2010, probably wouldn't have begged the question, but there is a certain amount of time, especially related to the economic data in terms of gross state product and employees.
Yeah, I thought it was something data related, but a little sooner would be nicer.
Okay. If there aren't any more questions, I'll just tell you that we in the Office of Intermodal Planning will be back in front of you in the coming months with other presentations. Our first one will be on the regional performance measures for the MPOs, and you can see them listed there. And then a topic that has been of great concern to this group, at least since I've been here, is where we are on the corridors of statewide significance, and we will be back to you with an update of where we are, and then, as promised, a recommendation of how we move forward from there. And any of this information that I've presented today is available in a much greater level of detail at vtrans.org. You can see all 50 measures and a description and trend lines of those. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Lane.
I want to get back to Dr. Davis's question in the previous session. Clearly, our ability to not push some of these contracts out is hurting our preservation and maintenance. And we are no longer treating maintenance as construction projects. Is that correct? In other words, remember we talked about we're not doing that anymore as far as planning and stuff.
Chairman, I certainly understand the question.
We were told at a previous meeting that one of the reasons that construction was being, or maintenance was being slowed, is because we were treating the maintenance project with the same rules as construction projects.
Yes.
I just want to confirm that we are no longer doing that.
We're not doing it. We're trying to get these construction projects, maintenance projects out quickly. I think if you look at what we've done the last few months, we've doubled what we've put out for maintenance projects. And we're going to double that again, or we're going to double the amount that we do maintenance cycle. So I think we're making progress on that area. We're getting the projects out the door. The projects are going out the door. Mr. Chairman, I would also bring attention to the quarterly report that's at the desk, where we have measured some of our on-time, on-budget for the maintenance and construction projects.
Yes, Ms. Clement.
Mr. Secretary, I caught your word that said the amendment to stop transfers from the Transportation Trust Fund.
Does that include what is listed in Mr. Lawson's presentation as support for other state agencies? That, which is about a $42 million item, or DMV?
Well, the only transfer that I'm aware of, and correct me if I'm wrong, John's in the room somewhere, is the money that we transfer out of to public safety, which is for enforcement of our corridors of safety.
Don't we also do DMV?
Yes.
Yeah, is that the transfers you were talking about?
No, I was talking about if you take, in a perfect world, the formulaic money, and then because we are a maintenance first organization, we actually take money from the Transportation Trust Fund that could otherwise be over into the highway, the HMOF, as John said, you know, several hundred million dollars a year just to keep our maintenance at a reasonable level, even though, as I said, even given that transfer from the TTF to the HMOF, we are still below our targets.
So that's the
yes.
Transfer. Yeah, gotcha. All right.
Mr. Chairman, I guess there was one question as far as maybe on Mr. Worley's comment is all the contracts that we've awarded or preparing to award and many that we've got on the agenda today to be approved by the CTB, have we had any situations where there's been the contracts have been held up because of lack of CTB approval? And
Mr. Chairman, we do not have any contracts that have not been approved because of because we couldn't get CTB approval. That's not the issue.
And I guess that begs the real question, and it's part of the legislative proposal in which we're increasing the amount for commissioner to approve the contract from $2 to $5 million. So I saw that as part of the legislative package. And I didn't remember any period of time in which we had problems with contracts being awarded because of failure of CTB action. So I just really didn't understand or know reasoning behind that proposal and the bill to be passed.
That benefits the DRPT director and the commissioner, so I'll let them answer that.
I'm sorry I didn't catch all the questions, but what we're just looking for was just more efficiency in moving out the projects quickly. It was an efficiency move, not that the CTB was holding up approval of the contracts.
I guess, Mr. Chairman,
yes.
My follow-up question would be, I wasn't aware that, you know, there was inefficiency built into the system or part of it because of that amount, because I think raising it to $2 million that we did the year before last probably was good to the extent of some of the smaller contracts, but then we're talking about moving it now from $2 to $5 million, and during that time frame, I'm not aware of any issues or complaints that would have been demonstrating the need for that, and I'm having difficulty understanding the need for that type of increase, because I believe if you look at the contracts that we awarded last month, 13 of them were awarded, of the 13, 9 were under $5 million, which means that would have been signed by the commissioner, would not have come before the board. I just think that that's less transparent way of doing your business. So I just bring that in because I know that we were awarding the contracts, and I happen to remember that was part of our legislative package.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Miller?
A question I didn't ask when that package was briefed to us. In a typical year, if you went back and looked last 3 or 4 years, say, how many projects would we typically have? How many would be $2 million or below, and how many would be $5 million below, and how many would be in the balance? In other words, the total number of projects, how many were impacted by this proposal? And to Mr. Keene's point, I'm not sure whether it's a good or bad proposal because I'm not here long enough for that yet, in terms of my own view on it. But what was is there an inefficiency with this board that's creating that need? And I understand efficiency, and I commend us for every time we can find a way to be more efficient to do so. But Can you help me with that a little bit? What percent of the projects would be impacted by the change?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have
5% or 50%.
I don't have that information with me. I know we have it. Keith, I don't know, did you bring any of that with you?
And I don't need an exact number. I'm sort of trying to feel scope here.
Mr. Chairman, Keith Martin from VDOT's policy office. I believe on average for the last 5 years, it ranged anywhere from 40 to 60 projects you're talking about that falls between the $2 million and $5 billion range.
And what percent of, how many projects would we have typically in a year? I'm trying to look at the impact. So 40 doesn't mean anything to me. Is it 50% of the projects now would go forward without us? Is it 10%? Did it move from 10 to 20? Did it move from 10 to 80?
I'm sorry, I don't have the actual percentage, but I do know the actual numbers of how many projects that's included.
Can you get that? Give us some idea what that is.
And then what percentage of, what dollar percentage is that?
Right.
Okay. But we can get that information.
Yes, Ms. Lottison.
Mr. Chairman, we had referred just briefly to the this document earlier. I was wondering, I looked on the back and I noticed a VDOT land use for truck rest area, and maybe I'm missing where this is, but...
It's in the Stanton District, yeah.
Pardon?
It's in the Stanton District.
It's in the Stanton District?
Pretty sure it is, isn't it, Greg?
I'm sorry, I didn't...
The
I didn't
truck rest area on 66,
yes,
it's
yes,
in the
that's
Stanton,
in
Stanton
District.
Well, it says it's in the Stanton District, that's true, but it's talking about Interstate 66 in Warren County. And my point, my question is I drive that road quite often, and I don't know of any in the eastbound lanes that's abandoned or unused property, but I do know westbound lanes there was an area where it had been originally set up for a rest area and was boarded up or gated up, and it's not being used. And I'm just wondering if that is a misprint. It should be westbound as opposed to eastbound, unless there's another area that I'm not familiar
that's
with.
That's in Fauquier County, I think. That abandoned one.
County? Could
well,
you
this
that
is talking one? About directly Warren County.
Right, right. But the abandoned one is in Fauquier.
No, there's one in Warren County as
is
well. Maybe it's on the other side of.
Yeah. I think it is. I have to double check.
Okay.
I apologize.
It's on the other side,
yeah. I can get that information in just a few minutes,
okay.
and let you have it. But it was an old rest area. You got it. Right. It was an old rest area that had, you know, it was property with a drive
yeah.
through it,
yeah.
but had never been, nothing has ever been constructed there.
Okay.
So at the request of the County Board of Supervisors, we are letting it be used for truckers. There's some porta-johns and some trash receptacles and things.
It certainly
like
makes sense, and it must be on the eastern side of 340, between 340 and 81.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lauterbach, as you come in eastbound on 66, as soon as you come off of 81, it's within 2 miles of 81. And it's basically an old abandoned truck rest area, and we're reopening it based on working with the community and the county board.
Okay. Right, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, we just had a report on that from our district administrator, and they've been keeping records of the use, and I think within a short period of time we'll have a report on whether or not it seems feasible to continue and to make it really useful. So we should have a report back pretty quickly on whether or not it's going to work.
Mr. Peek.
Since we're talking about rest areas, I know we've increased funding, but they were talking about the use of inmate labor to maintain it. Is that something we have addressed or spoken of or approved or not approved? Has it come before us? Is it all the General Assembly?
General Assembly.
All General Assembly. All right. I'm off the hook.
The, basically, we're asking for... Basically, we were asking for... It was interesting. The state allows, the state code allows us to use inmates on state highway system roads and facilities. And when we looked at it and asked the Attorney General, they indicated that since it doesn't say interstates, it's a separate definition, that technically we aren't allowed to use inmates on interstates. So that's really what the bill that just got us, it's passed already the House and Senate. It's going to be signed by the governor very shortly.
Just for those of you who get questions about that, as you go back, and it's nonviolent criminals who were trying to mainstream for reentry. So it's a very, very small group.
These will be state prison inmates, correct?
Yeah.
Not local jails.
No, local jails have a separate program, but they do essentially the same thing.
Bigger inmates and CTB members, if you guys agree. Well, you know, this is one thing, when this thing came up, I don't think people realize that the people that do most of the landscaping and work around the Capitol for all inmates. We had to point that out when some members got very upset when this issue came up, and we just said, well, you know, the people right out the door here are all inmates. So, sir, was there another question? Ms. Tyra, thank you very much. Actually, we're just going to move the agenda just a little bit up to allow Ms. Busher and Terry Brown to talk about the kickoff of the six-year program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Chairman and members of the CTB, myself and Terry Brown from DRPT will be talking about the kickoff of the fiscal year 12 through 17 six-year improvement program, and at the end we'll talk to you a little bit about the dates that we're looking at for the public hearings. The numbers that I'm showing you provide on this slide provide a small history of where we've been and how we've had to revise our budgets, obviously, as our revenue declined in the economic downturn. So you'll see revised 9 through 14, 10 through 15, last year's program, and the proposed resources for this year's program. Now, these numbers come from the six-year financial plan that John was talking about a little bit earlier. So it accounts for increase in the TTF and those things. As you can see, we've added a couple of informational lines. We've got the highway construction program at 7.2, rail and public transportation, or DRPT, at 2.4. I've included the Garvey debt service. We're looking to issue over 3 years approximately $1.1 billion of Garvey direct bonds, and the debt service is approximately $500 million. And we're paying that debt service back with federal revenue. So I've included it here as a separate component of the highway construction number. And then the VTIB component of the governor's funding package, I'm showing at $400 million. At this point, the $600 million that was looking to partially capitalize that program, it doesn't look like that will come into fruition at this point. So we're going from $4.8 billion in the 11 through 16 program to the $10.5 billion.
Mr. Secretary?
Yes.
Because we're talking, like with Garvey, it's debt service. That actually translates to programmatics that would be up in the highway construction line?
Yes.
What is this? I mean,
the only reason I'm separating it, this will actually be shown in the debt service portion of VDOT's budget, but it's revenue that the federal revenue is coming from the highway construction program.
But if you go down to the totals, it's 7.8 to 10.5, which represents 2.7.
Right.
But isn't the program, because you've got debt service here instead of, or do you have the program, the projects, whatever you want to call it, that services,
is
that
in,
folded in the highway construction?
It is.
And how much is that?
It's $1.1 billion. Now, what you're not seeing in this total, though, keep in mind, is a portion of the advancement of the CPR bonds was for previous commitments, where that money was used for both DRPT and VDOT. To approximately $600 million was in previous commitments as on projects and to match federal dollars. To get into the highway program development, the actions that we've had to take to date in the development of the program that we had to use to deal with the reduction in state revenue since June of 2008, and you talked about a couple of these a few minutes ago. Basically, as the state revenue went away, we had to reduce all available state funds from projects. We restricted funding to project phases that are obligated or plan to be obligated in the current federal fiscal year or underway. And again, that gets back to maximizing federal dollars to meet federal strategy. And we suspended the state formula distributions for unpaved roads, primary, secondary, and urban systems. We also eliminated the distribution of the federal STP formula to individual localities and regions and concentrated those resources on projects centrally so that they would actually could be used more efficiently and move projects forward instead of distributing them in such small amounts that they weren't actually able to fully fund a phase. So, and we focus those dollars on underway projects, deficient bridges, and deficient pavements. And when we weren't sure when we were going to be able to issue CPR bonds, we reduced the use of CPR bond proceeds to federal match at that point.
Jim?
Yes, Dr.
Have we reached a point now where you might consider unsuspending state formula distributions for unpaved roads, primary and secondary and urban systems?
We are not, and it's not anticipated that we will be in that position for this planned construction cycle, the 6 years. I think John mentioned that a little bit earlier, that the state revenue increases don't get us to that point during this planning period.
Mr. Chairman, I may ask what the trigger point is? Because this is an issue that I think needs to be examined as a state policy. And if we've set something in our thinking that says this is not important, it needs to be reversed. I'd like to hear what the trigger is when we would be able to go back to making those funds available. Because the longer we wait, the problems grow by huge proportions.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Davis, I believe John indicated he would provide that information at the next CTB meeting.
Is it possible, Mr. Chairman, that to have some discussion about the decision to suspend the distribution of funds for that purpose? It just seems to me not to be wise state policy. I think I understand trying to meet federal match is very important, but I think to abandon your whole philosophy of what you need to do in the Commonwealth with one part of our road system doesn't make sense.
Well, I think the issue is just how much money flows through it. The last time money went through the formula, how much money was it, do we know, just generally?
It was probably in 09, was it the last?
It was in 09. And
I think in order, and I'm probably shouldn't be stating these numbers, but just to make the formula work at its bare minimum, you're probably going to need anywhere from $150 to $200 million. Now, that's after meeting all of your commitments, whether it's match, et cetera. You would probably have to have, at just the minimum, $150 to $200 million. I think that's probably what John is going to come back with. But then the question becomes, if you run 200 million through the formula, then what does it do when you spread it all out? And are you able then to create a good project with a small amount of money? The issue, I think that's the real issue of it. So then the question becomes, what is the right amount? Is it 200 or then is it 400?
I guess, Mr. Chairman, I'm less interested in the distribution formula than I am addressing the needs of unpaved roads, primary, secondary, and urban system projects. And if we're not going to have an allocation or distribution, I think we have to have some prioritization of the need for funds in those areas. We cannot just stop all work in that particular sector of our road system. And that, I think that's what we've done, unless I'm just
understanding. I'm going to disagree. I don't think we've stopped, but please correct me if I'm wrong. It's just the idea, and this gets back to the commissioner's comment, $100 million, when you say it, you know, sounds a lot. Divide it up amongst all the localities. Next thing you know, the amount that's going to each project in each locality isn't enough to keep up with the inflation costs associated with the projects. The idea that if it's that low, I don't consider that viable. You say 100 to 200 might be viable. I'm not sure that that's viable. Now, in terms of making sure that we've got a pot of money and there's a part of it that's going to these functions that get identified, so we can go in, finish a project, move on to the next, but that way we can put sufficient money towards finishing a project rather than insufficient money to even keep up with inflation on all the variety of projects that get allocated. I get very, very concerned about the spreading it so thin that nothing gets done.
As I said earlier, I'm not so interested in the distribution formula as I am in doing something in this particular area. And I don't have the assurance that we're doing very much in that area because they're too small to be addressed by the federal match and the other projects that we're talking about. And as a result, we've abandoned doing anything to speak of in these areas. Am I wrong?
Mm-mm. No, for new construction? No.
That's right. We've abandoned that whole part of our highway system in the Commonwealth,
Mr. Chairman,
and it's not right.
In many cases, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Ms. Kim.
In many cases, we've sat here and we've understood that a project doesn't know whether it's a construction or a maintenance project, and we've heard that before. In many cases, these funds were expended just to maintain. A certain project could be called a construction project, but it was really maintenance. Now, what has happened here? We've got 37,000 miles of the 57,000 we've got that are in this category. And we're getting down to a situation where a lot of these funds were used for drainage corrections and various projects out there in the counties that protected the integrity of many of these roadways. Now these funds are not coming that way, and the infrastructure is crumbling. We'll continue to crumble. It'll do it at a faster pace. Compounded with the problem that we've eliminated or we've reduced revenue sharing program, and the revenue sharing program where we get a double bang for our bucks is just a double whammy on this particular segment of our roads. I agree with Dr. Davis 100%. It's an area where we've abandoned and ignored that we really need some attention on. We need to address it. And while larger parts, you know, the metropolitan areas have the MPOs that can address things like this. The planning districts are just not prepared and can't handle those out there in rural Virginia.
Mr. Chairman? I'm sorry, I'll be here. Ms. Coulomb, Ms. Lane, to come over, Mr. Rich.
I think Dr. Davis has his finger on something very important, but I would also remind my colleagues that secondary roads actually do exist in urban areas as well. This is not a rural
urban system.
Yeah, this is not just a rural system problem. But I would remind my colleagues that one of the things that has confounded us in our time of service here is actually the strictures of that funding formula, which actually do not allow us to respond to problems as they appear. They allow us to respond the way the formula dictates, and that's the dilemma we're in. Is there's not enough money flowing down to the various parts of the formula to allow us to move. But there's two things to keep in mind. Number one, most of the money that is programmed for transportation actually does not go through that formula. So we have other ways of doing it. Second, we do have a second set of allocation criteria that we use, including performance measures and other things. So it's not that we're completely shut out here, but this, I think the viability of the formula itself is in jeopardy, both from lack of funding, but also because there probably are other allocation measures that will allow us to respond more realistically to the challenges that we face. So we're lamenting something that maybe ought to just wither and go away in favor of something that's much more performance and system-based.
Mr. Lane?
Chairman.
I'm sorry, Mr. Lane.
I was
going to
say, as a practical matter, what's happening in Hampton Roads is if you see cities taking money off some projects and putting it on those that they can get completed, or finding alternatives, ways to subsidize, whether it's through their general fund or other projects. But Hampton Roads also has the rural areas, and those are where I see where they those counties have not taken the step, or maybe don't have the money to prioritize, where I see things not getting done, at least in Hampton Roads. So,
Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry, Mr. Rich, and then come back to Ms. Cooley.
Yeah, I just wanted to share the concerns of my colleagues, Dr. Davis, Mr. Keene, Mr. Lane. I'm concerned about adequate funding for secondary roads, and I think we have to address this. Specifically with respect to the upcoming six-year plan, I want to know how much is coming into my district and the other districts, and why. We seem to be at the bottom of the barrel. I know that I don't think they really have any performance standards for secondary roads. It's just kind of a hit and miss thing. I think for primary roads there is kind of a systemized examination of the condition of the roads, but in secondary I don't think there is. And we really need to address this problem. And I think Dr. Davis has an important point.
Mr. Boone?
I agree with Dr. Davis's approach. If the formula is to be abandoned or at least modified, I think we need to look for a way, an alternative way, to accomplish what that formula formerly accomplished. It seemed to have worked a long time and worked fairly well. If it's not working now, we need to modify it or replace it, but we need something to pick up the slack.
Next slide.
Mr. Chairman, before we abandon that.
And I thought. Dr. Davis.
I know you're aware of the problem because you dealt with it some in Prince William well. But I do think, at the least, we should figure out how to have an allocation in our six-year plan budget to meet some of these needs. And at the least, I think the revenue sharing program was a way that that could be done in counties and cities where they could afford to provide the match. And by not having at least that, I think we as DTB ought to consider funding that program again, because it had such a positive impact on many of the localities. There will still be several that will not be able to take care of their needs because they won't have the match. But at least we ought to be addressing some of those needs. And I'd like to recommend that we ask staff to come back to us with some thinking on how we can address this issue fairly and not just turn our head and say it's not a problem, because it's a major problem.
This is why in the governor's package we have in there revenue sharing, bumping the program itself up to a maximum allocation of $200 million a year.
Yes.
And then, just as important, you know, it was $1 million per project limit. I mean, it was a traffic light cost you $600,000, $700,000. I mean, so we're asking, in fact, it's in both the House and the Senate, to go up to $10 million. So that goes from $50 million a year up to $200 million a year, $1 million per project up to, he's writing my cheap notes, up to $10 million per project. And that will be in the 2012
budget?
In 2012, we're looking at $50 million, and then
but the next year,
escalating that in the out year.
Yeah. So that way, what we'll do is we'll start to program that up, Dr. Davis, right up front. What we're going to start doing is, like what we did this year, we'll start asking for what people, what the localities are interested in doing much earlier, so we can program it into the budget for the following year. But that's one thing. The second thing is, we are going to have, you know, just general discussions about, it's not just the formula, it's just the way we do things generally. This year, I mean, I think everyone does recognize, I mean, the governor is very serious about coming back. This year on his package was just really one way to jumpstart the program. We're going to be next year talking about maintenance, talking about the sustainable funding for construction as well. These issues, I mean, it is just because the way the formula, though, works is that, you know, when you go through all these other mandatory, the fact that we have to meet these other mandatory requirements, whether it's debt service, whether it's federal match, whether it's maintenance, by the time we get down to the formula, we run out. And so the question is how do we start to get some money back to our secondary roads and our urban roads? How do we deal with this? And I think is unsustainable as well, where the urban roads now get dramatically more dollars than secondary roads in counties. So you have situations like Arlington, Alexandria up in Northern Virginia get dramatically more per lane mile than does Fairfax County, which in some places are as if not more dense than the urban area. So,
Mr. Chairman, my final comment, let you move on. It appears that the two areas we have the greatest trouble with the way we're currently doing things because of the economic conditions and a number of other issues, we have trouble with the really big projects, tunnels and interstates, I mean, 300 miles of 81 and others. We have trouble figuring out how to where we're going to deal with that. And then on the very bottom end, our secondary roads and local needs, that's where we seem to have our greatest challenges, thinking either really big or thinking small. Everything in the middle seems to be, we seem to be addressing them pretty well.
Yeah. I will tell you, if I had my druthers, I personally would like to pull out bridges as a separate
category.
Yeah. Category. If you did that, then at least then when you start looking at some of these other issues for the formula, you're really then focusing on maybe some real good improvements in these different areas. I do think that even when we've looked previously at the formula, what projects were done, a lot of it was bridge replacements that were called, you know, new construction or whatever. I do think that we should end up, we've been having discussions about how you end up having at least a separate item for just bridge replacement. Just go to the top of the list and just every year just keep on putting money in to eat those away. You know, eat at that list.
Thank you for your patience.
Mr. Chairman, one question or point. You'd mentioned the amount of money that is spent in certain localities on a lane mile that, because they've got the roads versus what others. I wrestled with this because, you know, one answer is for other localities to then opt in, take over the maintenance of their roads, receive the more funding. But that isn't a long-term answer, because if every community in the Commonwealth did that, we run out of money real quick and it all goes back to the original amount. What's the solution there? How do we get it to where we're able to apply the resources to where they're needed and still do it within the budget that we have before us?
You need a budget.
It's a discussion we have to have over a drink.
Maybe
a couple of drinks.
That's right.
Enhanced revenue sources.
See, Mr. Farrell, I mean, this is going to be something we're going to have to just, you know, the one of the things that we've been trying to do in the last year, we brought on George Mason Public Policy Center. Essentially brought them on to just what if questions, some policy issues just for us to be able to maybe chaw about, and one of them just looking generally at this relationship between the state and localities, and
in their preparing, just as something for people to think about, looking at the relationship between states. I mean, we're on the few states that we control everything. And and how do we make sure we're fair, or how do we even look at providing funding in the future for this? So it's something we're going to have to discuss as a Commonwealth.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr.
To address the here and now, do we have the authority to move some funds from primary to secondary?
No. No, this is statutorily based. The formula is statutorily based.
Without additional revenue, we can't
That's
add
right.
any to the secondary?
That's right. I mean, by statute, it says we have to meet debt service first, a federal match second, maintenance third. Get through those three. There ain't much left. And that's generally the other problem when you hit that second tranche, that federal match. Then what we end up doing is we focus on all the roads that are federal aid qualified roads. And so you're looking at interstates, your big primaries. Then you start searching like we did last year for other projects that might be federally qualified to put money against. But then what does that mean? That means the vast, vast majority of secondary roads in the Commonwealth and urban roads don't qualify for federal aid. So therefore, you take them off the table, which means, and this is why when you look at where our money is being spent right now, I think I saw the construction numbers that I think 52% of the state's highway construction money is being spent in Northern Virginia alone. And this is because they have all the federal aid qualified projects. So, but that is all statutorily based. We did talk to members just to get their feel for what if we were to try to come in with a new way to classify the roads and how to potentially change the formula. And it just isn't the time. I think next year we're going to have to come back and talk to those out.
Thank you.
We are going to come to you about talking about reclassifying some of the roads already. It's something that is in the power of the CTB is to reclassify some roads. Some roads that are secondary today should not be. I think we still call the Prince William Parkway still considered a secondary road. Fairfax Parkway, I think, is still
secondary.
It's a secondary. That's just crazy. When we started looking at giving us statutory authority to do it, we found that actually the CTB has the authority to change these. And I think we're going to have to embark on an effort this year to classify the roads for what should have been done a long time ago. But then also then coming back and looking at how we get money to these roads.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what you've laid out is something that we've come to understand over our years on the board, is that push comes to shove, we actually have a federally directed highway program.
Yes, that's exactly right.
The state's refusal to generate new revenues for itself limits the state's ability to define its own needs and respond to them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's confounding. You don't have to be a real deep-down, dyed-in-the-wool conservative to find that odd that a state that constantly discusses state prerogatives.
Did you say you're a conservative?
In the course of this discussion of federalism.
I got to wait. Did we tape this? I want to make sure I play that back.
That raves against, you know, states simply becoming administrative units for the federal government. And to not respond to this kind of problem is baffling. Now, I know academics are going to take that up for us, but that's part of the challenge, I think, is to really understand what's happening here, and that's really the bottom line.
Yeah. And going back to, I think, Dr. Davis, way before one of the previous discussions, and maybe Mr. Lawson or maybe it was Mr. Tyra up here, about some of the problems with this. I mean, they did federalize everything to make it all... Every project became a federal project, or at least anticipated so that they could swing money onto it. And once you did it, but it made our situation even worse. So it's going to take us a few years to get out of this, but it's going to take more money. It's going to take also working with the General Assembly to get them to look at the money a little bit differently.
Thank you.
Next slide.
Yes. The proposed highway priorities for the development of the fiscal year 12 through 17 six-year improvement program update. Some things are changing based on the fact that we do have the proposed governor's funding program and the resulting bond proceeds. We continue to fund deficits on underway project phases as a first priority, maximizing the use of federal funds to meet federal strategy, funding project phases that are underway or starting in federal fiscal 12, funding deficient bridges and paving projects as we can. We are looking to put some increased funding on preliminary engineering phases of projects to get some shelf projects back on, or get some projects back on the shelf to move forward when additional funding is available. And as part of the governor's program, we're setting aside some of the bond proceeds to support the development of the PCTA program and projects. We're looking in all possibilities to accelerate existing projects using the additional funds, again, the bonds, CPR bonds, and Garveys. And we're working with the MPOs in terms of allocating funds consistent, and MPOs and localities in terms of allocating funds consistent with how they'd be obligated and expended. In other words, funding the projects by phases as the projects develop instead of front-loading funding, especially federal funding, and not being able to obligate it timely. And as we've been discussing, we're related to RCPC MAC, but safety projects, enhancement projects, and other projects, looking at inactive balances and either redirecting or getting those projects moving forward.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr.
Chairman. On the PPTA element, does that run through the six-year plan?
Yes.
Those numbers are reflected in here.
Yes.
Right? Okay. Thank you.
As John talked to you about the revenue picture and the activity this year and provided us with our revenues that I showed you in the first slide for the 12 through 17 update, we are releasing, or what I should say, allocating on projects, the Federal Revenue Reserve that we were setting aside previously. So we are allocating that reserve balance, about $500 million, a little over, and we'll be programming that on projects. We are taking advantage, and we have FHWA approval to use our what we call toll credits or our soft match that allows us to not have to use CPR bonds as match, that we can use 100% federal funds on a project. So we can replace CPR bonds on the projects as match and add additional federal money for that 20% match.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Ms. Kim.
Back to the first bullet where you're programming the federal revenue, the reserve we had in the $500 million, that was never distributed to any. It was just set aside as a reserve. What would be the model for distribution on that as far as how that should be applied throughout projects in the state?
Exactly as we would have done before, funding deficits on projects, making sure we can get those funds on projects that need those monies to be obligated timely. So we would look at the release of the 12th funds in 12 to maximize federal strategy and move project phases that are ready to go forward. And we'd be looking at deficient bridges and paving projects. And some of that also may go as the backfill on projects where we're removing CPR bonds as matched so that we can use our toll credits to make a project 100% federal.
Mr. Chairman, so you would say then there's not a model, that there's a prioritization list of
yes.
approach to it?
Yes.
Chairman, you may also state that a portion of the federal revenue would also be going to the MPOs.
Yes, when you look at that Federal Reserve, about half of it, or a little over half, is discretionary in terms of VDOT, but there's a portion of it that goes to enhancement, and I think Mike will actually be talking to you about in a few minutes the extra money that is now made available to the enhancement program. We got additional safety funds. And the MPOs have been notified of their additional resources for RSTP and CMAC out of the release of that reserve for programming. onto projects. So a good portion of that is special program funds is what we call it, and we will use the distribution methods related to those funds that we already have in place, like enhancement and safety, to program those funds. We are also, that's it. The program funding from the governor's transportation funding package, the CPR bonds and the Garvey bonds are being programmed over the 3 years. Now, a portion of the CPR bonds is in fiscal 11. There will be a sale this May, and that's the funding for the previous commitments I mentioned. Then there will be two more sales in 12 and 13. The Garveys will be sold between 12 and 14. And a good portion of the Garveys will be sold in 12, about $620 million in 12, and then about $240 in each of the years, in each of the years 13 and 14. Again, we mentioned the state construction formula suspension. As the commissioner mentioned, and as I think everyone is interested in and sees the benefit for the revenue sharing funding, we are proposing at this point in our six-year horizon $50 million each year for the next 6 years for that program. But each year that we update the program, that will be reevaluated in that we have a much larger, we're hoping to have a much larger cap once the legislation is approved through the General Assembly on that, and as a revenue, state revenue becomes available, we will be looking to grow that program. But for sake of our existing situation, we have added, it went from the 15 to the 50, increasing $35 million a year. So I think that's a good start back in that program. We are not actually at this point programming the VTIB grants or loans in that they are just that, grants and loans, and we would be working out a program development process for determining how those funds would be dispersed. But if you'll remember from the illustrative governor's illustrative project list, we did indicate that we thought that the grant component of the infrastructure bank should focus on urban and secondary projects for the very reasons you all had the earlier conversation. That might be an opportunity to move some of those projects that needed some additional funding to complete those and get them going. Could potentially come from that grant program.
Mr. Secretary,
yes,
given that we're looking at our three transportation bankers, what we read going on within the General Assembly, money not going to go into that, the seed money, or may go into it depending on which version of the budget, how does that stand in terms of making this a viable transportation infrastructure bank?
Well, it's included in the House budget. Well, first off, the legislation itself to establish it is they're identical, both House and Senate. So from an authorization and a programmatic standpoint, I mean, there's a couple minor tweaks, but we're working through that. The issue really is the budget itself. And the $250 million they're fine with. And then it's really the issue right now we're dealing with is the $150 million from last year's surplus. By statute, where I think we're already quote unquote guaranteed $36.5 million. Thirty-two now?
Yes.
Okay. So the question we're really dealing with right now is the other $120 million. So that's all part of the So we're
so 250 would be put into.
It should be $282 million.
Okay.
The question is the other $118 million?
Okay.
That we're working on. So it's still a good corpus to start, and you know, obviously the budget has not been approved yet. So, but that's we're continuing to work with Secretary of Finance, as well as the House and Senate money committees about this issue.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, do those funds go through the regular six-year plan?
No, not necessarily. But the way we're setting this up is that the CTB will have a role in actually determining, or actually when projects come forward for somebody who wants to get a loan. Remember, the issue here is we're going to see localities, maybe some of our public-private partners, come forward to us with loan requests. And then the CTB will have actually a role in saying whether it's a worthwhile project or not. And one of the things we'll be looking at is obviously as a fit into our plans. But then we'll essentially vote on moving forward on the loan, the project and the loan. Then the Virginia Resources Authority is actually going to administer the loan for us.
I think that's very constructive to bring the CTB into that, as you say, so that we can kind of match it up with the six-year plan. That all goes together. So I'm really appreciative of that.
Well, the thing is, I just want to caution you is that it's a lot of, you can imagine a lot of it's not going to be six-year program projects. I mean, because this is one of the reasons when we discussed initially the CTB's role. I mean, the port projects are going to be eligible. The aviation projects are going to be eligible. We've already had some localities come to us and where due to other changes in Virginia code regarding proffers, you know, you used to be able to require the proffers be paid up front. Now they have to be paid as each unit is. So some localities said, well, I got a project. I need a new road to service this new development. I got proffers coming in. If I use that for my payback, you know, if I need a road built. Now, that's not going to be in our six-year plan program. And obviously our six-year program is financially constrained, but it may be something that is essential to the locality to even service the very, you know, development. That so it's, in this context, it may be projects in the six-year program. I will venture that more often than not, they will not be in the six-year program. So the question will be before us is the project itself worthwhile, and does it make sense when you look at, you know, we'll have to come up with criteria on actually how to administer it and looking everything from economic development, transportation mobility, transit opportunities. I think what we'll be having to look at is coming up with a program that actually hopefully can actually get some projects going that make some input. But again, when you look at only the six-year program, it's either highway or transit or rail. Right. This is going to be much broader.
Right. Thank you.
So next slide just is for me to let you all, remind you all that the federal authorization or continuing resolution, I guess, that we have expires in March. And at this point, I don't know if they'll give us 30 days, 60 days, or through the end of the federal fiscal year is another continuing resolution. So it'll be interesting to see how that unfolds, and we will be watching that with bated breath to see how that might impact our overall obligation authority for federal fiscal year 11 and onward. But it'll probably be another 18 to 24 months before there's a new authorization. But I know they're beginning to work on it. I just included this slide. I used it last month. It just, again, highlights the three funding components of the governor's program for your use, the Garvey bonds, the infrastructure bank, and the acceleration of the CPR bonds.
Yes.
Is the strategy on the Garvey bonds, it's not a one-time hit. I noticed we got $400 million in debt service over the, and then $1.1 billion program. Is the intent to keep about $1 billion out there all the time, or is this a one-time use of these Garvey bonds?
Chairman, the total authorization is $1.1 billion. At this point, we've only planned for that amount over the 6 years.
Okay.
But that would be a board decision as to whether or not, once we pay down that amount,
okay,
would be a board decision as to whether you want to issue new bonds or not.
Okay.
The authorization would be there once you pay down the existing debt.
Right, that puts us at capacity.
All right. Thank you.
Also, answer this.
We also presented the illustrative project list last board meeting, and it does contain some contingency projects or more projects than the governor's funding package, and we hope that if bids are coming in less than anticipated, or if there's a project that is not able to move forward for an environmental or some other reason, that we have the ability to go to the contingency projects or the projects that further down the list that are ready to go and substitute those. And again, this next page just discusses the criteria that we used and we discussed last month to include projects on the list. And we received input, as you know, from yourselves, district administrators, some regional entities, and localities related to the list.
Chairman?
Yes, Ms. Garcinski.
I know you were a press reader when we had to come up with that list in fairly short order, but once the budget is finalized and you know that number, would we get a chance then to, again, review where that list may end up so we can... How's that process going to work at that point? Because it, in all likelihood, may not be as much money as you anticipate.
Well, you'll have that opportunity. We will use those proceeds as part of the update to the six-year program. So when we present you a program draft, the projects that we're able to fund based on their schedules and their availability to keep to our window of bringing them to construction as soon as possible, you will see the projects that are in the program using those funds for your review in the April, May timeframe. And we will then have public hearings for citizens and the MPOs and everyone to look at those as well in April and May, and then you will adopt in June.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Rich.
I think there were a few on the illustrative list that were new projects that were not in the six-year plan. I recall. So I don't, that isn't a total limitation, as I understand it, because I may have one that is not in the six-year plan now, but we can discuss that later during the six-year plan process, right?
Sure.
Okay.
It's a cheap one, I hope.
Well, we'll just have to see how far the funding
Bruce.
Stretches.
There you go.
That's the name of the game. The schedule for the highway program development is February, March, April, May, June timeframe. The financial information for the six-year program is now available. We've provided this information to the districts, the MPOs, and we have we've opened the electronic tool that's available for secondary and urban projects to be reviewed and edited as need be, and we will be coordinating with the MPOs on the RSTP and CMAC and other special program funding like revenue sharing and enhancements, et cetera. In March, we will just be all of us moving forward with the programming and the development. April, we will look at that board meeting to present to you a draft, which then becomes public. There will be a comment period, and we're looking to set up 4 public hearings. We will have one in Richmond, Northern Virginia, Hampton Roads, and Salem. The Salem would include Bristol, Lynchburg, and Stanton. The Richmond would include Culpeper and Fredericksburg. And we right now are looking at probably May 18th for the Richmond public hearing, May 4th for NOVA. And we'll send these out once the locations are confirmed. Hampton Roads, we're looking at April 27th. and the Salem area, the location is still up in the air, so that may change, but we're looking at May 12th, but I'll send this out formally.
Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Rich.
In the good old days, we used to have these in each district, and I can certainly understand why we truncated it recently, because there hasn't been any money to talk about, frankly, so why go through it all? But now that we have this, I think, an innovative proposal instructed from the governor, there's more funding, and I'm noticing people in my area have more questions about how this sounds good, how's it going to benefit, how can I get involved with my project. Might we consider going back to having these in each of the districts? There are not many people in my district who are going to go to Richmond or going to traffic in Northern Virginia. And I don't know about the rest of the district, but I think it might be helpful. It sends a message that we're trying to listen to the constituents. So I wonder if you could consider that this year, since we are moving forward a little bit. Not as far as we need to go, but you say we're coming back next year. I think that's wonderful, but I think we're on the upswing now, and maybe if we got out to the people, it might be beneficial.
Well, we can take a look at it. I think one of the things we also have to be cognizant of is that VDOT has 1,000 less people. I mean, and all I'm just trying to point out is the same people doing these, setting up and supporting every one of these public hearings are the same people who have to put the six-year plan together and put it to bed. And there really isn't a lot of folks left. We're down to bare bones over there, and I am very cognizant of the fact that we're at an organization now of actually well below. I mean, in reality, we've laid off 1,000, but where are you now?
Still 6,800.
6,800, so we're actually down almost 1,500 people? So I want you all to think about that I mean, we are authorized at 7,500. We're only at 6,800. That means that over the last 2 years, we have a reduction of almost 1,700 people. And when you look at our planning and programming staff, I think I'm seeing almost all of them sitting out here. Everyone who's planning and programming, raise your hand. Yeah, that's so I got my four or five. And, we have to be cognizant of trying to, of the fact that we don't have staff to go out and man, quote unquote, staff these things. But we'll take a look at it, see what we can do.
The district offices, I think, would help.
I know, but they're the same issues there. I mean, with our district, all of them, I mean, again, we're 1,700 people less than we were a year and a half ago. And that's central office and also out in the field. But we'll see about trying to make it a little bit, maybe picking more central location. I know we've always had the Fairfax City Hall. It's a lovely, lovely location, but maybe we can mix it up a little bit and try to get more central location.
We're actually looking at the Potomac.
Prince William County,
Coffer
you know, the Prince William County is much more central.
There's a couple of alternatives, perhaps. If district members, and one of the things I've been looking at is doing, we'll call it a town hall.
Yes.
It would be a formal public hearing. Speaker and others have the district administrator there to go through what's in the six-year plan and address questions in general. I mean, would it be possible to get representation out of central
and
office?
The DAs go out and try to do it like that. That'd be fun, too. Again, I'm just very cognizant of these folks here. When it's a formal public hearing, it means that we have to do the notice, we have to keep records, there's a lot more that goes into it than just showing up for the day. And it's just as important if we end up having, whether now nine districts, I mean, nine districts, nine hearings, at the same time trying to set them up, staff them, and then do the work that needs to be done.
We're very cognizant.
I'll send you the invitation.
Mr. Chairman.
I'll stop on my way home. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
But I'm not in favor of either here, but just to address Mr. Rich's request, wouldn't that type of meeting, though, be productive in a sense that you're going to have to meet with MPOs anyhow, and you're going to go meet with the planning districts, mm-hmm. whereby that if we went to the district with one meeting, we wouldn't have, if you come to Bristol, you're going to have several planning districts that have a meeting. Sure. So it may be that we are consolidating by going to the district more so than we are scheduling additional meetings. So there's an additional thought there to look at.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of ways to combine this. So I think,
Mr. Chairman,
Starzynski.
I want to carry on this conversation of transparency and outreach. Would it be possible to also just have a public hearing, if you will, electronically? Save staff time, and if there were one date where you could get on the web and come in and, you know, in essence, make your comments electronically to the department on the six-year plan, would save people a lot of time and would give people an opportunity to use what they're doing every day, and that's being on the internet to get their thoughts across.
I think legally we're not allowed to have, are we or no?
I think we can. Is
we have an email address where people can submit comments.
Yeah, I'm just saying we can't have a public. I don't think we're still allowed to have an electronic public hearing.
Joanne.
Yeah,
we would need to set up in each of the 9 districts for the electronic link.
Okay.
My thought was not that it had to be that formal.
One of the things that we do need to take into consideration in terms of the timing of the input, that if there's anything that comes up from the communications with the citizens, the MPOs and others, and yourselves, between the public hearing and the final, we do have to have time to accommodate any changes that are made. So we do look for the communication and the public hearings to be earlier or as early as possible in after the board meeting in April when it does go public. So we do try to have the meetings and the outreach the end of April, the first part of May, so that we have time to accommodate any updates or changes that may occur. And also that could be from the General Assembly as well.
Mr. Chairman, following up on what Cord suggested, that maybe we have a town hall meeting or something. Are there any restrictions on those? We don't have more than one member there, maybe, or maybe two.
Well, that's the thing. If there's more than 3 members?
Two.
Three
or more.
Okay. So we could have an at-large colleague with us. And no more, and then we could just conduct that as we see fit. We don't have any guidelines. Do we have to turn the comments in, or maybe we just do our own thing?
Would the clarification would be, is this meant to be a town hall but not a public hearing? If it's not a public hearing, I think that's a different. I gotta let council speak.
I think what we'd have to do is look at what the purpose is. If the purpose is to in any way provide input for the six-year plans, et cetera, there are probably going to be federal rules you'd have to comply with, et cetera. So it's really going to depend on what the purpose of the meetings are. If they're totally, if you want to do something totally outside all of the meetings associated with the normal approval processes for the budget, et cetera, or for the six-year plans, that you might be able to do something like that. But again, it would depend on what is the purpose of this meeting.
That's the six-year plan.
Well, I don't know that you could do that, no. I think you need to have something more formal.
In my case, what I'm thinking of is to discuss transportation in a regional sense. It would touch on the legislation that's going through and what's there. It would touch on the program, what's funded. It would be broader than just a six-year program, but it obviously provides an opportunity for them to comment on the major projects that are funded moving forward that happen to be associated with the six-year plan.
Yeah, we'd have to look at that. I mean, there may be some implications, you know, involved with funding, et cetera, that I can't begin to think of all the possible issues. But bottom line,
We can certainly look at the question. And the issues you're going to have to be very careful about is having more than two CTB members at any meeting. Again, what is the purpose of the meeting, and is it intended to fall outside? We've also got public participation guidelines for the CTB that we'd have to look at, et cetera. So
had a great idea about consolidating. That would save staff if you got to meet anyway.
Actually, they've been doing the meetings with the PDCs and MPOs via video.
Well, we've had two face-to-face, and we have been communicating via email and video. So we have been reaching out to the PDCs and MPOs and have received their long-range priorities as well. And we will do that prior to the draft being released. So we will have another session with all the MPOs and PDCs. And that's partly what this next slide speaks to. And if we wanted to catch up a little bit of time, I could just turn it over now to Terry Brown with DRPT to start their section.
Come on up, Ms. Brown. As you can tell, we're not an inquisitive group today.
I'm telling you. I had thought I might be running a little late if I got here at 10:30. So. Good afternoon, everyone.
Sending a message. So what time do you want to leave?
Oh, no. I'm here all day. I'm fine. Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. I am Terry Brown. I'm the Manager of Financial Programming for DRPT. And I just wanted to run through our application process and our funding information. We are completely different from VDOT. We operate through a grant application process, and we are just now starting to go through our applications that we received from our transit grantees and TDM grantees. We closed our grant cycle this year on February 9th. Usually it's a couple of weeks earlier, but we had a new grant application software that was built by our in-house folks, and it proved to be quite challenging, as so many of the software packages do. So we are now, our grant managers are going through all of those grant applications. We receive several hundred every year for our different funding sources, and they are going through those, and they will soon turn them over to my staff, and we will go through all of the approved applications and come up with the six-year plan, which we will bring to you in draft form along with VDOT in April. So our funding sources are, we receive 14.7% of the Mass Transit Trust Fund, and we're at about $115 million for the last couple of years. Right off the top, we have $1.5 million that goes to Paratransit Human Service. It is right now 2.5. We have a bill before the House and Senate to change that to 1.5 because we feel like that's going to meet our grantees' needs better. If we reduce it to 1.5, we feel like we will be providing them with enough vehicles because that goes directly to capital vehicles, but we'll also have a little bit more money to put to operating. Then 73.5% goes to our operating needs for our transit grantees. 25.5% goes to capital, and 1.5% goes to special projects. And that's three different types of projects. Those are our, we still call the projects demo, which is under the state code, it is anything new and different. We used to fund some new routes. Or anything special that you wanted to try. We are considering going back to the, right now we're focusing more on new ITS, anything new you've got as far as technology that you want to try is what we're trying to focus on. We also are fund out of this, we fund interns, and because we're trying to lure transit professionals into the field, and not people to come in and do scanning. We actually have people who have to finish an essay to tell us how they appreciated their summer with the transit grantee and let us know that they actually learned something about transit. And the other one is technical assistance. So we have a lot of requirements before we give our grantees money for anything like a new route or something. So this is the funds that we would give folks in order to do some planning before they came in and asked for something new like that. From the construction funds, we get some money for TEEF, which is projects that are for congestion mitigation. And so this is TDM, our transportation demand management. So this is rideshare, van pools, telework. This is anything that gets cars off the road. And $3 million goes to rail preservation, which is capital funding for what we call our short line railroads. So these are the non-class one railroads. That's not what I meant to do. Okay. The recordation tax goes directly to our operating. It has been $23 million annually. We started getting it in 2009. I noticed in I started with the department in 2007, and I noticed that our first six-year plan, we were anticipating that this number was going to be about $46 million in 2009. So, of course, the ugliness started in the fall of 2008, so this right away, even before we got our first dollar of it, was half what we were expecting, so that was unfortunate. We also have our capital bonds, which help us. And so this is $60 million of transit capital bonds every year. And these are the construction, the CPR bonds that Rita was speaking about, plus $50 million, which are also coming from those bonds, for the WMATA State of Good Repair. And those bonds are matching the $50 million of, well, it's $150 million from the feds, $50 million from Maryland, $50 million from D.C., for a total of $300 million every year and $3 billion. I can't do math while I'm standing up, over the life of the 10-year grant. Of course, there's a bill in Congress right now to take that away, but I don't think anybody thinks that'll pass. If they get rid of the federal portion of that grant, then our match would go away. And then REF and our Rail Enhancement Fund and Rail Preservation also gets $12.9 million of bonds, and those are just divvied up as needed per capital as well. Rail Enhancement is funded with a vehicle rental tax, and Rail Enhancement is capital funding for our Class 1 railroads, and in Virginia, of course, that's Norfolk Southern and CSX. And so we have quite a few projects in that on that page of the six-year plan as well. And then we do have federal funds. Most of our federal funding that this $40 million represents is funding that comes to us, and we give it out based upon the applications that we are going through right now. We have funding that goes to the rural grantees that we apply for and give out through the FTA, who is our cognizant agency. We have planning funds that that we give out to the MPOs. We have all sorts of grant earmarks, federal earmarks that we apply for and give out. So our funding is different in that it's application-based, and we go in and apply for it. We also have a lot of pass-through funding that we flex from FHWA through VDOT and deal with the grantees that way. So our major funding concerns, since everybody else has been telling you and you've been asking, one of the big things for us is that we are not very flexible as far as operating costs. We have got quite a few pots of capital, and by that I don't mean to say that we're comfortable about capital, but we've got federal funds that we can cover capital with, and we've got a couple of different state capital funds and things that we can move around. And this last bullet, we've been able to address the CTD's stated priorities, that the State of Good Repair is the number one priority. And we actually have a another in-house built system that allows us to do that with our asset management system. And we make sure that, you know, when our grantees are coming in and asking for replacement rolling stock that they needed and it's met its useful, the stock they're trying to replace has met its useful life, and that they're buying what they need and replacing what they should and that sort of thing. So we're, at this point, we are able to meet those needs at 80% matching funds for capital. But operating, last year we were at 15% operating funds, matching, you know, giving them their state funds. And that is just so low. it's our lowest point. And the problem is that we have what we have for operating. We have that 73.5%, and that's pretty much it. Now, as you see, we've, over the last 2 years, we've had some deobligated MTTF funding. Once it goes through the program, once we've put it through that 73.5%, 1.5%, and 25%, it has been our understanding from talking to the CTB over the past several years that at that point, once it's deobligated, once it's been given to a grantee and taken off a project because they had a little left over or something, that we can move it around as long as it's still spent on transit. So we've got dribs and drabs that we've put onto operating. And then special projects, the way that's written up in the code, we can put 1.5% on special projects, but we're not required to. So we'll have a little bit of that left over, and we've moved it over, but it's not enough to be significant. So the operating is really our biggest concern, and especially when we have some big boys lurking. We have the Tide is coming online down in Hampton Roads next year, and Dulles Phase 1 will be online the following year, and then Dulles Phase 2 maybe 3 years after that. That's going to probably triple our operating program when they come online and start asking us for funding. And so without another source of funding, you know, that would be a third of what it is right now. So at that point, it's pretty meaningless for if we're only giving out 5%. So that's our biggest concern. So SJ 297 is asking us to do a study of all transit-related issues in the Commonwealth, and we're very happy about this. It looks like it might pass. The calculation for operating is a big pie of money, and everybody who comes in gets their share of the pie. And so that's why the Tide coming online and the two Dulleses is going to be a problem. I mean, we're happy about those two systems, but they're going to come in and they're going to take every dollar that they take, takes a dollar away from Blacksburg Transit or GRTC. So we are concerned for the people who are operating. I mean, we're out there doing a good job of advocating for transit, but when they come in and ask for money, you know, we don't want to be saying, well, thanks, but so we also feel that the calculation is out of date. It's been done this way for a while, and it doesn't really give any sort of impetus for somebody to run a lean, better organized system. And also, some of the salaries are specifically excluded from the calculation, and we'd like to take another look at that. Like I said, I've been here for 3 years, but people who predate me have no idea why they're not included. There could be a really good reason, but nobody really knows. So this is what we're hoping to look at under SJ 297. Performance, prioritizing, well, we want to prioritize the capital request by categories, which we've started to do, but we'd like to take it further. Right now we're required under the MTTF state code that be evenly distributed. So we have the capital bonds for right now that we can use to float and give people different percentages, which is what we did last year and what we'll do this year. But if when the bonds are done, we'll be back to MTTF, and everybody by state law gets the same percentage, regardless of whether you're asking for a bus shelter or shop equipment or to build a facility or to buy rolling stock. So we would like to have the ability to prioritize the capital requests based on your categories you're buying in. Whether we should hold systems harmless at the existing levels, evaluating whether the 14.7 is enough. And then the code language allows transit funding up to 95% for capital and operating. We don't actually, I mean, there was talk apparently right before I got here that with the influx of the $40 million of
recordation.
Thank you. Recordation taxes that we might get to 95% on a couple of our systems. But that quickly went away. I mean, yeah. So we are now at 15%. We're not anywhere near 95, but, you know, God willing, we'll get out of this economy and maybe we'll get close. So, and one of the other things that happens is the folks that are out there who are savvy, they know that that language is there, and they sort of say, well, you're not funding us up to 95% like you're supposed to. So we have that conversation way too often. So this would help us as far, this is going to help us as far as we would like to say there may be a fare that is appropriate for all transit systems to charge. You know, if somebody decides not to charge a fare, is it appropriate that they get the same operating assistance as somebody who has decided to charge a dollar? So basically, we're all paying their fare down here because they've decided not to charge a fare over here. So things like that are the questions that need to be answered. We don't know the answer right now. Oh, there we go. That went back too fast. I don't know how to go back.
You're at rail.
What's that?
You're at rail funding concerns.
I know. I don't know how to go back. Oh, it's pretty. I don't know. Can you help me? Thank you. So our rail funding concern is also operating in nature. Thank you so much. Our rail funding is also in operating in nature. We have the Rail Enhancement Fund, and it is supposed to be capital. Thank you. It's supposed to be capital in nature. Now, you may have to go forward again. Oh, there we go. Okay. It is rail enhancement is by statute capital as well, and we have the two trains that we have started up, the train from Lynchburg and the train from Richmond. And the train from Richmond will soon become the train from Norfolk. The temporary fix that was put in the Appropriation Act last year gave us $6 million from the Rail Enhancement Fund to spend in operating assistance. So that was great. It said that we could spend it across 3 years. We thought that would only cover 1 year of operating expenses. However, the Lynchburg train has been fantastically successful and is actually paying for itself and making a profit. So the $6 million is going to last us, it looks like, it's actually paying for part of the Richmond train now. So it looks like it's going to last us a little while. It may be enough to last us for into this year a little bit. We're going to start having to pay money, though. So we're going to run out of that $6 million sometime this year. We have no other way to pay for the rail operating funds. And this has been in the newspaper recently in the Charlottesville area. I know I saw it on the news. That if we don't find another source of the operating funds for the rail service, then we won't be able to pay what our commitment is. And in the six-year plan last year, we did indicate that all of this was unfunded, which was unusual in the six-year plan. We don't usually put in anything under there that's unfunded, but we wanted to make that clear because REF is capital. So the other thing that's clouding this up is, of course, once it starts running from Norfolk, it's going to be a further operating cost, and that's scheduled for 2014. And then in 2014, under PREA, we will have to begin picking up the cost of Amtrak trains in Virginia. So we will have the two trains from Norfolk and from Lynchburg that we started, and then the four trains that run right now under Amtrak. So the full cost of that is $25 million, which is what we came up with under the study that was done last year for the General Assembly. And that is a huge concern for us because we have no way to pay for that. The CTB can allocate up to 10% of the money from the highway funds for anything that will mitigate highway congestion. So it's possible that, you know, that you all can give us some of that, but of course you have other funding issues as well. So, but you know, we just have to come up with something that's going to fund rail operations, or those trains will shut down. And Rita is gone, but she's already mentioned this. This is the public hearing information. So.
Any other questions? Excellent.
I feel so left out. Is this because I explained it, or is it because lunch is coming?
No, it has nothing to do with lunch. But since you mentioned it, why don't we break to lunch? Everyone grab. We'll start up again at 1 o'clock, okay?
This is
I know, that's what I'm saying. I have one aim on right now. Estes, Mr. Estes, you're up.
Are you ready for me? All right. I'm going to try to be as brief as I can, and hopefully we'll have some fun with the Transportation Enhancement Program today.
All right. More face time for the least amount of money.
That's right. Can we talk about how we allocate the funds?
All right, Mr. Estes, go for it.
All right, here we go. So you guys know this by heart by now then. So we won't spend much time on the policy discussions we talked about last fall on, you know, kind of how the allocations are spent. I'm going to jump right to the meat, which would be slide 3 here. We talked a little bit about revenue projections, and Rita mentioned the reserve earlier, so we're looking pretty good for our allocation. Our 10-year average, as you'll see here in a minute, is around $19 million a year. You'll see this is about $27.2 million for FY12 if you take into account the FY11 reserve. And based on the policy that was adopted last fall, you can see that the $4 million off the top for the statewide initiatives distribute the remaining 75% to the district members, and then the remaining goes to the at-large members. You can see that breakdown there. I'll go through in a minute what you have in front of you as a package dealing with that. When you get to the package, and everyone has a folder, looks something similar, hopefully, to this at the table. And when you get into the scoring criteria or the scoring sheet, you'll see every project that was submitted an application. And you'll see a score for when that project was originally scored on the 0 to 100 range. And you also see the priority ranking score, which most of you should be familiar with, we had last year, which basically we consider that a readiness score on a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being that the project is ready to construction, for construction. That additional allocation will bring it to construction. We look at other things to kind of give you a little bit better feel. Some of the board members in the past have asked us for additional guidance and input on where the project stood, that attempts to do. I won't spend a lot of time on this. This is our normal chart that we've gone through before on kind of how the board's allocated money. I will just simply say that we've focused a lot the last few times on what I would say, again, I'd like to acknowledge the board's efforts last year to focus the money on existing projects. You can see the stat that I pull out, not only focusing on existing projects, but focusing on fully funding projects. And that third column from the right shows that the board last year, 74% of the requests were fully funded. Again, a major move, I think, in the positive direction. That doesn't come as a one-dimensional thing with the policy changes and some of the things we've done over the last couple of years in the program. Mr. Keene and I were talking before the board meeting about, again, reminding me on the multidimensional aspect of that. The board can only do so much from a policy perspective, but we need to make sure we're doing on our end to support the local governments who are doing these projects and getting them through the process. What we've done to try to help highlight some of that, and I would, I guess, encourage other board members to look at things like Mr. Keene has done, is talk to the project sponsors to see where the holdups are on their end or on our end, and let us know. He's brought to light quite a bit of good information in the Bristol District. The district summaries that you're going to have in your packets, for the district members, we gave you your district and the statewide list of projects. For the at-large members, you have the whole state. And what they represent is basically every project that's received enhancement allocation since the inception of the program, and they're broken into status. You can see the allocations by year. You can see the expenditures. Again, just another tool to provide the board members a venue to see where the projects stand and how they're looking. We spent, or Julie Brown spent some time with you guys in December talking about the deallocation of funds. I'd say the takeaway from this slide is, you know, through this deallocation process that the board endorsed in December, we've reviewed, you know, hundreds of projects. We've identified almost $13 million for possible reallocation. And as we've done the last couple of years, your package includes, for the district members, funds that have either been identified for deallocation or funds that have been identified for possible deallocation. And we'll be working with you to help allocate those funds through the normal process as well. So that's also included in your packet. I think it's important to note when we talk about you know, where we are on moving projects and how things are moving along and how the expenditures are going. You know, we have a rolling list of projects that we send out notifications to sponsors, and we call them the 45-day letters. And basically, if we haven't seen an expenditure over a certain amount of time, we haven't seen an agreement sent back to us, we'll reach out and touch those sponsors to make sure they're moving. And if they're not, as all of the board members, I hope the district members know, we reach out to you and talk to you about the status of that. So, you know, at any given time, we have a handful of those out. We have about 20 of those in play right now. What I want to do is, if I could, Mr. Chairman, take a few minutes to walk through the package that you have with you. And what everyone should have is a summary, which, taken with the PowerPoint, basically repeats the same kind of thing about the allocation for members, how the allocations are broken out, a listing of all the scores. Again, we talked about the different scores that are on in the program. Got a copy of the current policy that the board adopted. Got a copy of the deallocation process that Julie went through with you last year. We talked about the deallocation, reallocation. We got this breakdown by district for each member or each district member to consider. And then the district summaries I just talked about, which again is that highlighted spreadsheet that gets into a great deal of detail if you'd like to go there with your individual projects. Probably most importantly, at the end of the packet, in addition to you all know how to get a hold of me, there are the staff members that if you can't get a hold of me or if you've worked with them in the past, and I encourage you to work with them in the future, they represent your districts, and we are more than willing and able to sit down with you individually or on the phone or however you see fit to walk through the applications that you have in front of you, and recognizing for the small amount of money we talk about, it is quite a cumbersome and expensive process that we go through, but we want to make sure you're comfortable with it. So with that, from a process standpoint and next steps, today everybody has, you know, again, the applications that came in December 1st last year. We're asking district members to get us their selections to our staff, to me, or to the staff listed on the contact by March 9th. We'll take that, compile it, and at the March board meeting, we'll have a handout for all the members where you'll see the district members' tentative selections. That'll be out there. And as we've done in the past, then the at-large members will review those. We'll put together staff recommendations based on what we're seeing for help on suggested ways to help close gaps, things that we've done in the past, with the intent to sit down with the at-large members and walk through the final selections hopefully in April. We do try to parallel the six-year plan process as much as possible. We have heard feedback before from the at-large members that it works better to meet at the day of the board meeting, so we might try to do that again in April and then have something available that we can include with Rita staff's efforts on the public hearings for the six-year plan. We'd like to have the tentative selections be a part of that process. So with that, that's the quick go at the enhancement. I'm sure we have a couple of questions, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Mr. Davis? None at all? Excellent.
I have one quick thing. You put up what was getting closed out this year. We've got it restricted to ongoing programs. Some of them would be requested at fully funding, and if granted at full funding, how many active projects would remain open and versus?
I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Turner, I can answer that accurately. If you look at the number of requests, I guess I'll do the back of the envelope if you don't mind.
Well, 27 out of 41 million, right?
That's my back of the envelope. Thank you.
27 out of 41?
We have 27.2 million plus the deallocation amount.
So not all projects that are out there that have not yet been fully funded did come in for an application.
That would be correct. I don't have a good feel
we
for
don't have it. If you,
right.
Just curious.
And not all of the requests that are coming in for these existing projects complete those projects. As
right.
example, we looked at some of them are coming in for $300,000 this year, but they anticipate coming to the board again over the next couple of years. Matthews County was a good example. Yes, sir.
Mr. Lane. So this is an inclusive list now. This is our list to choose from. Okay. And then just a quick question. I know we agreed that we would fund at least 50% and $200,000, but I just want a clarification. If someone asks for $300,000, are we allowed to fund $150,000 or is it $200,000?
Great question, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lane, our interpretation would be you have to fund $150,000 of that request.
Okay, so if the initial is over $200,000, less than $200,000 or less, you got to go to $200,000.
Yes.
Over that. Okay, thank
yes.
you.
Mr. Miller?
Well, question. It says shall receive not less than 50%.
Right.
So if they ask for $300,000, you could give them $200,000.
Oh, I know.
You could give them $300,000.
But I'm just looking at, I want to make sure that what I was looking at, how I wanted to break it down. In other words.
Right. But am I correct there?
Yes, sir.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Just not less than 50%, and if it's 200 or less, and they fund the whole thing, it's got to be 100%.
All right, if it's 300, you can fund
it. You got it. Yeah. We prefer, the more on it, the better.
All right, my question, Mr. Chairman. The ranking system that you're using, and I'm not personally familiar with a lot of these projects, but the one I had a meeting on the other day was the Schooner, Virginia project, and you have the ranking of that, I think, as a 3 or 4. Maybe it's a 4.
4.
And I don't understand that ranking because the project is basically completed. It's being transformed, and it's got a lot of debt associated with it, and what they're trying to do is pay off the debt. So the boat's in the water. It sailed around the world or halfway around the world. And the number 4 doesn't mean it. I mean, I'm kind of like, how do you get to 4? Because I'm just looking at your very sort of base cost.
Right. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Miller, I'd have to get back to you on the 4. I can do that.
I just didn't know if I was misreading something or whatever.
Just that particular project's had a major change in focus. It's going to be based in Nautica.
Right.
Really for port activities. And so it seemed like it would score a little higher, I guess.
I would think, but I'm not advocating for it. I'm
right,
really just trying to understand it.
It's a good question. I will look into that. Because like you said, that we try to look at ones that haven't gotten out to bids or out to construction or out to completion yet.
And how do you – is there – given that we have this process that I'm enamored with. How is it?
We had that impression, Mr.
And we'll, I'll keep talking about it until it's
done. How do you feel about the at-large?
I feel the same way that Mr. Sterling feels. Just because we did it that way before, if it's not right, don't keep doing it that way. That was a CMAQ quote, I think.
It's a matter of perspective. When you're at large, you see it one way. When you're district, you see it another.
And by the way, he was at large only about 3 months ago.
I know. I mean, it's all flowing downhill. I'm getting
All right, Mr. Miller, go ahead.
I'm trying to get to business here. Is there a G-allocation process associated with the at-large members? And I didn't see that reflected. So where's that money?
The way our deallocation process is, whether it's a project selection.
All the money from the at-large members then goes back to the district members.
It goes back to the district members.
That's even more special. So we're even lesser equal than we were before. And then the last question is, what does an urban at-large member really mean? What is urban in our state in terms of how you define it? And I know it's not necessarily every part of every district, but how do we define that?
Would it be
where should my attention be?
Richmond.
I've always assumed it to
the
be...
chair. My attention should be with the chair, right?
I've always assumed...
There is actually a definition how, because we actually...
Roanoke, Lynchburg, Fredericksburg...
The Census Bureau has urbanized areas.
Well, no.
Urban in your somewhere in our documents.
There is actually... We went and there is an actual definition that they end up having somewhere in the statute. I will get that to you. I'll tell you why, because we actually, when they were looking at the appointments and stuff, they found certain people did not qualify in. Like Fauquier is considered rural, but it was like, but Culpeper wasn't. I mean, it was just very odd the way the thing was being, and I don't know how, but there is an actual definition. We can get that to you, because it's actually, I think the Secretary of the Commonwealth is the one who sits on the criteria. And there's certain counties and certain municipalities that are considered urban, others are not.
It's actually a fairly simple definition, Mr. Chairman. It's the percentage of residents who live in an urban area as defined by an incorporated city, town, whatever. So you could have a very rural county, but if 90% of people live in Culpeper, it's urban, not rural. It has nothing to do with this sort of character.
Yeah, but like Prince William is considered urban, even though
there's
no county. And it's nothing incorporated except for Manassas.
That's right.
But we will get that.
You can
out
just help me
you.
With that. That'd
you
be
will
really
get
great.
That information. Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, just a comment, maybe not necessarily a question, but also a challenge as we look at the changes that the CTB has made. To the extent to make this enhance the enhancement program to the point that we're going to see money extended more rapidly and we're going to see more progress behind that. And part of the reason for doing that was the criticism we received for not spending money. Now that we've made those changes and we're awarding projects and we have projects in the system at 100% funded, I think it will be, the burden will be upon the staff to produce. And I think that's where a big part of the problem, not necessarily the staff, but the process that they had to go through was encumbered them from delivering in the past. And I hope that we've solved that, but I'm not so sure we have. And the reason I say that, because knowing that we were going to discuss this, pulled a couple of examples before it came, and I asked, of the 53 projects that intend that we had fully funded, the one that I asked them to look at from a district level had not even received an administrative agreement. Now, that was awarded in July, I guess. I would think that an administrative agreement, I don't know, but something like a cookie cutter agreement, a generic agreement, that could be generated pretty quick. Yeah, but that hasn't been done, and that's one sample. That's the only one I sampled. And then if we look at some of the projects in the system, it just takes an extraordinary amount of time. I know there's hurdles in there, inherent in the system, that may be preventing us. It's not the staff that's doing it. It's all the agencies got to go through, all the steps have got to be taken, And the real question is, can we live up to the expectations of getting this money expended within a couple of years' time after we get it started? I'm beginning to doubt that we can live up to the expectations because of the system and the process that they have to go through. And I think I wanted to state that while this is great, this is good work, a good thing that we can look at making improvements, but I'm not so sure that the changes we made in our policy on 100% award has solved our problem.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, I wouldn't disagree with some of the comments from Mr. Keene. I think he's brought to light some things that we have to work on our end. I think we've always said it's a multidimensional approach. I think we're up for the challenge. I think part of the problem was, you know, we weren't fully funding all these projects, and we were, you know, some of them were laboring through the process. Now we have a challenge to get those through the process now. To the agreements, you know, I did, one of the things that we do, I think, from a proactive standpoint is when the board approves projects, and if you look at the chart here, you know, there were 16 new projects that were approved last year. And what we do is, as you know, when sponsors apply, we have applicant workshops to help those sponsors work through the application process. Once they're awarded the projects, we have sponsor workshops after the CTB provides money to get those folks on board with how to get those projects started. And we actually bring those agreements to those sponsor workshops with those localities to make sure they kick those off and get those things going. So we do a lot of hand-holding with those local governments, trying to help them get through that process. But there's always room for improvement, and I think Mr. King's brought some issues to our attention that we need to look at.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Miller.
Just scanning through this, again, I'm just trying to do this so I understand what these charts are and graphs are showing us, On Hampton Roads, page 4, it shows Cape Henry Lighthouse restoration, and it's purple, meaning it's under deallocation. But when you go to status, the status is completed and under agreement. So if it's completed, does that mean they just didn't spend all the money, or is that what that means?
Without
money left over.
Getting into detail, it could be purple if, for example, they've haven't spent all the money that's on the project, and that's part of that reallocation process each year. Is we'll look at projects that are closed out, and then we'll grab that money and put it into the normal allocation process. That's exactly right. Yes, sir.
So is it safe to assume that if it's completed and we're deallocating it, then there's just money left over?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Thank you.
Okay. So the second phase would be a different color item.
Yeah.
When I call you on the other item, we'll walk through that
thanks.
One as well.
Thank you. Yes.
And more than one member can get the same project.
Absolutely. Yes, sir. And that's part of, as the process-wise, you know, district members will look at a project. They'll be talking to the at-large members about some of the intent, and then that's why we get together as a group with the at-large, is to kind of bring that to fruition.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Rich.
No question. I just wanted to thank Mike for getting all this work and getting this organized for us. Appreciate it.
Excellent. Run now, Mr. Estes. Run
or
leave the door.
All right. We have revenue generated by disposal of VDOT.
Not
property. Friendly Johnson.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, CTB members. I just want to give you a little background on disposing of surplus property for capital outlay, is which I'm going to talk about, but there is a different code for surplusing right-of-way property. So on this slide, I just wanted to kind of give you the code sections that relate to right-of-way and to capital outlay, but my presentation will be based on capital outlay. Currently, VDOT has 9 district complexes. 29 residency offices, 248 area headquarters, sub-headquarters, chemical storage lots, and storage lots, with an original value of about $288 million. The Appropriation Act, Item 457K.1 of the 2010 Acts of Assembly, requested us to take a look at our properties. We had to conduct a study to see if we had anything that was surplus. We have 48 properties, 33 we identified for disposal, and 15 we identified to lease. The next slide, this slide tells you where the properties are located by district, the offices, the equipment shops, area headquarters, warehouses. At the December 8th meeting, you requested a hypothetical $1 million sale. And you wanted to know what would be the difference in the proceeds if we did it or if DGS handled the sale. Both agencies incur expenses. We all have staff time, appraisal fees, survey fees. DGS adds another 15% to the actual cost of staff time and appraisal fees, and there's a 6% commission if they use a broker. But the bottom line is that if we sell it or if DGS sell it, the main difference is if we use a broker. Because the cost, the differences in the expenses don't vary that much. If you look at the wages, the direct hours that they use, our hours are a little bit higher because we do not have appraisal consultants on staff. But it all sort of kind of comes out to the end that the primary difference is if you use a broker.
If I might, just, you don't show us using a broker at all. Is that because we just wouldn't use a broker?
We would not. We would not use a broker. We would use staff from the right-of-way division.
We still get the right price?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
But I would also like to say that we have not sold that many properties. The last property we sold, I think, was in about 2008 or 9, and that was an area headquarters. A lot of our properties are between other agencies or other localities. No. To another state agency, yes. To a locality, there is a fee. There's a fair market value.
Chairman.
Yes.
Have we ever experimented with picking a site and deciding, let's see what happens if we use the broker? I mean, to try to generate revenue from what's sitting there?
No, I don't think we have, and I see the commissioner leaning forward. I'm not aware of any that we've done that way.
You know, would that be a worthwhile undertaking, Mr. Commissioner, or not?
Mr. Chairman, like Grilla said before, we sold very few of those properties, and I believe that when we do sell the property, a good many of them would end up going to localities. And also I noticed that, I don't think Grilla got to that part of the presentation, but often when DGS brokers the deal with localities, they do not charge or use a broker at that point. So we're looking at the volume of properties. It's just not enough there to really be concerned with.
Yes, the only time DGS would use a broker if it's a private entity that they're selling it to. Any other questions, Mr. Miller?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I have a quick question. Back on page 3, we identify total original value of the properties of VDOT is $288 million, and recommended 48 properties for disposal. Of those, the estimated value, is that the original? How does that compare to the original value that was?
That estimated is the fair market value, and I
in the down market.
Yes, sir.
That does not tell us how much we originally paid
no.
to have these
But we do have that information. I just did not put it in this presentation.
That would be nice to know. I'd like to know how much we put into these properties that we're now selling, which may be in some cases distressed sales.
I can get that for you, sir.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, just one thing. You sort of, I guess the comment that often they don't use a broker if it's going to a locality, I don't know if they engage a broker and then disengage them or they say they're not going to be used if it goes to a locality. But however that works, that would change the analysis substantially, obviously, to the point where it would cost us more to sell than it costs them. But if that had not been the case, and we're looking at disposing $12 million worth of property, that's about $720,000 worth of savings that we could have based on that 6% amount. And we're sitting here talking about we can't hold a meeting in the district, we can't come in the night before because of budget issues, and, you add enough $720,000 together, you got some real money. Certainly could do those things that we've talked about. So perhaps the analysis is flawed that I'm using because you basically just took that 6% away. But if the 6% was there, I think it would be incumbent on us to think real hard why we weren't doing that.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Mr. McCarthy? Isn't it part of the process, and I don't know if it's by law or by habit, that the property is first made available to other state agencies, and if nobody wants it, then it goes to perhaps the locality in which the property is located, and then after all that, only and only if that is not happening, then it might be put up for sale to a private entity. Is that about it?
Yes, sir. It is offered to the state agencies first.
They don't pay. I mean, it's just...
That's correct.
So it's a gift from...
A transfer.
Should we do this just before Christmas every year?
Well, we don't have a lot of transfers, and we do not sell a lot of surplus equipment. There's not a lot of... I don't think there's a great deal of market out there for the 13 properties that we have.
Yes. Didn't we just, over the last couple of years, at the direction of the General Assembly, close a boatload of VDOT properties?
And they're included in this analysis, sir.
We didn't get really a nickel for any of that, I guess.
As I said, the last time we received any money, I think, was for an area headquarters. I think it was West Point. And it was about $203,000 that we recognized on that. And I think that was either 2009 or 2008.
Chairman Swirley, we did abandon some properties when we were going through the blueprint process, but we purposely delayed disposing of the properties because we wanted to make certain that everything was working out. And now what we're doing is looking at all the property, making a decision on which one we can dispose, which ones we want to lease, and all of these are really coming from that blueprint process that we went through a year or two ago. So this is the properties. Now we're in process of selling. But we took a very deliberate approach because we didn't want to sell something and then have to turn around and reopen an area and have to buy land and build another building. So these are the properties right now that we abandoned, and we're selling those. Some of them we still are not certain, so we're leasing the properties rather than selling.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, I thought there was.
What are we being asked to consider today with this?
Oh. Nothing. This was just simply, there were questions about one last meeting?
It was a December meeting.
How do we dispose of properties?
The reason I ask the question is because it's my understanding when you sell public property, there's a very well-defined procedure and process in place that protects the employees who are trying to sell it, and the rules are pretty rigid, but they're there to protect the interests of the Commonwealth and avoid fraud. And I don't think we need to get any further involved in that other than to know that these properties are being disposed of because we've abandoned them.
I think one of the things that really... The questions that came up were two. One was, what happens to the money? How much money is generated? What happens to it? And then the whole issue on DGS versus whether VDOT should dispose of them or go to DGS.
Because the problem is that once you send it over to DGS, it they take a cut of it. So we get less money from DGS disposing of it versus us disposing of it. But that is where their constant lobbying is paying off, because they want DGS to dispose of it. But we lose money for the transportation program when they do that.
The potential risk, Mr. Chairman, of having someone do it who's not done it regularly also holds risk as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman?
Yes,
one other quick question. Looking at page 4 with the properties to be returned, what type of property is being disposed of area headquarters in Northern Virginia for only $200,000? I can't imagine that in that market. I can't imagine too much it's that small unless it's land.
Where is that?
That's an old area headquarters, a piece of property at Haymarket.
What is it?
Haymarket.
It's up
at Haymarket?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
It's adjacent to a correctional facility also, which I think has also been abandoned.
Okay. Right there on Route 15.
There's oil bearing drums on it too, right?
Yeah. I've not seen it, but
How did we arrive at these estimated values? I mean, they say market value, but how did you determine that?
We went to the appraisal people in our right-of-way division, who I have great confidence in, and asked them to give us their best guess, looking at assessments and other information that they had as to the value of these properties. And it's their best guess. It's not an appraisal, but it's good
That's
information.
That's good, yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, noticed Grinley here also that there's a $2 million warehouse for his central office. What was that? Was that just for storage?
Yes,
in Richmond.
That's Fulton.
Okay.
We've got the VDOT has a warehouse at Fulton that we have now vacated. We still have some other buildings adjacent that we're storing used furniture and other documentation and that sort of thing. But I think it's about 14, 15 acres down there that we said worth about $2 million, we think.
Any other questions? Johnson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Legislative report. Mr. Martin, come on up. Now, this will be fairly quick because the board had no questions regarding any of these issues last night.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Keith Martin from VDOT's Policy Office. I'm filling in for Rick Walton, who unfortunately couldn't be here today. As everyone knows, this is a short session. We're expecting the General Assembly to conclude business by next Saturday. There was over 2,500 bills introduced into the General Assembly. Of that, VDOT is tracking over 240 bills. I believe Mr. Walton came before the board last month and gave you an update on approximately 16 pieces of legislation that VDOT was tracking. Of those agency bills, as you can see, majority of them are code cleanup or they promote some sort of efficiency or streamlining of processes. Two bills I would mention, however, that Mr. Walton mentioned to you guys last month that are not moving forward, and that is House Bill 1660, which exempted VDOT's public roads and right-of-way from stormwater management fees. That was incorporated in House Bill 1737. That still is in existence and moving forward. And House Bill 1496, which allowed motor vehicles to be in the third lane on certain areas of the highway during certain situations, that did not pass out of the House. As you are aware from last month, I think Mr. Walton advised you about House Bill 1693, which raises the maximum limit on the waiver of appraisals from $10,000 to $25,000. While it was in the House amended the bill to clarify that the landowner would be told that they are entitled to a full appraisal, even though that limit is waived, but they're entitled to it. On slide number 4, House Bill 223 and Senate Bill 1004 are companion bills. They relate to the funding efficiencies and cost recovery. There are four main aspects to this bill. The first thing is that it exempts VDOT and DRPT from paying any fee for digital access to records. It also codifies what's been in the Appropriation Act since 2003 regarding what the annual rate of payment is going to be for maintenance to localities. It also does two other things that are pretty much code cleanup. It ensures that the payback provisions that require a locality to have to pay back in regards to locality when it chooses or cancels a project, that was updated to reflect current processes. And the Fairfax Bonding Authority statutory legislation was amended to reflect statutory law changes in the federal law. I would mention that back on slide four, this bill was amended to actually state that VDOT will apply the same growth rate to payments to localities' funding levels as it does to the base VDOT maintenance program. Regarding Senate Bill 1126, this bill would extend the contract solicitation cycle for environmental location design and inspection work on highways and bridges to one initial term of 2 years. This bill was admitted in the House, in the Senate, to ask that the commissioner appoint a committee composed of road building organizations and representatives of certain surety bonding individuals to review performance and payment bonding requirements and make recommendations to the commissioner by December 1st of this year. House Bill 1825 and Senate Bill 1005 are also companion bills. They have passed both the House and the Senate regarding the duties of the commissioner. This bill has five important parts. The first is that they change the title of the commissioner to the Commissioner of Highways. It eliminates the requirement that there be a person designated with a title of Assistant Commissioner for Environment, Transportation Planning, and Regulatory Affairs. It also allows VDOT's commissioner to transfer, abandon, and discontinue roads in among the primary and secondary systems in certain situations. It eliminates the requirement that CTV must declare excess right-of-way as surplus before VDOT may sell the land. And finally, instead of having 5 to 8 different reports every year, it allows VDOT to have one comprehensive report in the fall. This bill was amended both in the House and the Senate. Just to clarify that the information that was provided in the biennial report on the condition and needs is also in that comprehensive report that is in the fall.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
One question on the sale of land. And the bill requires that the CTB must not declare it as surplus. My question is, does the CTB still approve the sale? Does it come for them for approval, or just authorizes commissioner to sell?
The commissioner is authorized to sell.
Without CTB approval?
Right.
And finally, Mr. Chairman, the last bill, just to update the board on, House Bill 1758 is a streamlining bill to improve operational processes in three main ways. First, it provides that a municipality may decide to assume responsibility for construction on this program by notifying the board by December 31st instead of the current processes of July 1st. It exempts the Rural Rustic Road Program from the stormwater management regulations, and it also eliminates the requirement for a local governing body to hold a public hearing when provided notice that VDOT plans to provide or pave a secondary road within a locality due to an emergency. Right now, they have up to 30 days to make a recommendation to the commissioner. Under this proposal, it will be 72 hours.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I have a question on what's going on with this last bill, HB 1758. What's the impetus behind this?
Mr. Chairman, it was just a streamlining effort to improve processes.
More than a streamlining explanation. That doesn't tell me anything. The reason I ask is because there are taxpayers in my jurisdiction that want to have it, believe it or not. I wouldn't want to live on one. They don't want it paved. So this is going to, and a lot of the counties agree with them, so this is going to short-circuit notice. If they go, if VDOT runs in there and paves it, the county doesn't want it paved, right?
Mr. Chairman, actually the county does make a recommendation to the commissioner. It's just shorten the time period from 30 days to 72 hours.
So you're not going to go in and pave an unpaved road unless the county asks you, if you tell me that?
That's what the statute reads.
The statute is the same other than the shortens the timeline from 30 days to 72 hours. Yes, sir.
I don't see the need for this, but that's all right.
In emergencies, you can speed up the paving of the road.
Is this?
I don't think it's.
This applies to unpaved roads. This is not a repaving in the
it's
case.
Unpaved
of
road.
So it's an unpaved road. It's a construction project, and there'd be no public hearing then.
Unpaved road during an emergency situation.
It doesn't say emergency, but it does in the rest of the statute.
It does in the statute, yes, sir.
Okay.
What is an emergency in this case?
Yeah. What's an emergency?
I'll have to defer on the commissioner on what that might entail.
Oh. There's a road washout. The question is, when you go back, you put the road back, you want to pave it, and it really was just the intent to not have a formal public hearing. The locality still has to agree.
As long as the locality still has to agree, I'm fine on that. But I don't. Okay. I get you. Okay, I understand that. I just don't want VDOT to go in and pave these roads when the taxpayers don't want them paved. I mean, we'll save money.
Okay. The statute actually says that they make a recommendation to the commission.
Chairman.
Yes.
You didn't mention one that we asked some questions about last month, House Bill 1957. Is that dead or still alive, or what's going on with that?
The bills that are not mentioned are actually moving forward as is. This was just an update on changes since Rick Walton presented last month.
I think that one had a change, too. That was the one that increased the commissioner's authority for contracts from $2 million to $5 million and eliminated our need to look at outdoor theaters and a couple of other pretty minor things that I doubt anyone has a problem with. But I saw recently that it added another clause or two, which I didn't understand. I agree with the commissioner having, and the language was very specific, but, you know, without restriction whatsoever in any amount, dealing with some sort of local projects. And I didn't understand what that was about. It was new language since last month, because it wasn't in the draft that we saw last month. It had to do with projects that we approved funding for in the six-year plan, I think, but then which we would normally approve when it comes time to do them, and this would say that the commissioner has the authority to do that. Correctly, and I'm not sure I did, but I was just wondering where that stood or where that came from.
Those proposals are going forward as is, with not very much opposition at all. I would assume that the changes that were made before Rick Walton made the presentation. So since then, there's no changes been made to that bill.
Can we get a summary of that? It sounds interesting.
House Bill 1957, just look it up on your computer and let's see.
This is the deal with... I'm sorry. I just go back to Prince William County. We, if we had a state road, even if we paid for it, we would have to come to the CTB and get the contract approved. I think that's what this deals with. Is that right? Even if we paid for it, we administered it.
That's a different bill, I believe.
How many bills you got?
Oh, we have quite a few this year, sir.
Why don't you get a copy of that and then maybe come back and then we can share that with the member.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Thanks, Ms. Martin. Are you familiar with the eminent domain? I think it's a joint resolution or something that Senator Joanna was involved in. I think it's HJ 693 that would substantially change those eminent domain rules and would relate to, so it could have a pretty significant impact on VDOT in terms of compensation paid. Are you familiar with where we are on that? And I understand it went out of committee today on an 8-7 vote, perhaps, to the floor. Are we tracking that legislation?
Yes, sir, we're tracking that. And actually, if Mr. Richard Bennett is here, he's the one primarily working on that.
Are we staying out of that fight, or what are we doing?
We are working with the administration on those bills. There were a few of those.
I just don't know what the administration's position is on it. And it does have significant financial impact to VDOT on any condemnation that we would be involved in.
Every week the bills change, and that's one of them I think they're in constant negotiation with. Yes, sir.
So no real update, and are we supporting that, or are we not, or is the administration supporting that, I should ask, or do we know? It depends on what the changes are, right?
Yes, sir.
That's a good answer.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes,
go ahead. Do you know the status of 1957? Is it passed? Is it in committee? Has it been killed?
Oh, it's passed. It's come out. I believe it's out of both houses now, or will be out tomorrow. It has crossed over, yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I believe you were saying about stormwater management. Is it rural rustic roads that were exempted from stormwater management? Could you just define, you know, give us a definition of how rural rustic roads are defined?
Well, I can ask Julie, who administers the program. Julie, you might come up and explain it.
The Rural Rustic Road Program is an option for paving an unpaved road. And under that concept, it basically, you don't have to meet a defined standard. You can basically go in, you know, shape the road up, put additional stone down, and pave it. It's really intended to be a very low-cost way of paving existing unpaved roads. So it's really just a concept.
Okay.
Chairman?
Yes. That program does save a lot of money, and it seems to please a lot of the citizens. They get a road, but it's not a huge thing, and it blends in, and we save a lot of money. So I think it's a good thing. One question I had was on, I think the speaker had drafted these provisions that have been in law for a while, giving VDOT not a lot of authority, but some authority on corridor management, that type of thing. So are you watching these, and are we... are we protecting this authority?
Yes, sir. We as I mentioned, we're actually tracking and involved in over 240 bills. And if the chairman likes, and after the governor's veto session on August 6th, I usually do a report on the transportation bills, and I can do a report and actually work with DRPT's policy office if you like, and do a final. We'll report on all the bills that are out there and how they impact VDOT and DRPT.
Well, I just think it's important to preserve this authority that we do have to try to preserve the integrity of our roads. So if you all can keep an eye on that, I'm sure the speaker probably is.
Other questions? Excellent. Smart. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that closes out our work session. We'll go right into the...